Coming up this morning on your listener-supported volunteer-powered community radio station at 7:30, A. Proctor hosts Talk Radio. At 9 on Between the Covers, the guest is Lisa Tucker, author of Once Upon a Day, a novel about how a single day can change the course of our lives. At 9:30 on Words and Pictures, the guest is groundbreaking cartoonist Sherry Flanagan, who started her underground career with the infamous satirical group Air Pirates and became best known for her National Lampoon comic strip, Trots and Bonnie. At 10, local activist Patricia Barbera will honor the memory of feminist activist and author Andrea Dworkin on her birthday. We'll hear excerpts of the talk she gave in Portland over 20 years ago. And at 10:30 on stage and studio, guest host Emily Young welcomes Olga Sanchez, director, and Joanne Farias, playwright for The Road to Xibalbo at Miracle Theater. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Hello, cable members. My name is Yvonne Rivero, and I'm running for one of the posts in the new cable board of directors. For a long time, I have been working with communities who don't have a voice, a community of immigrants, and especially those who are of Spanish speakers in the foreign area. I have become keenly aware of the need of crafting a voice and in the importance of keeping economic viability in the media that represent us, and also in providing access to the media in this community that is growing and expanding in many ways that are invisible to the untrained eye. KVU has many strengths that have been developed in a sustained life of over 30 years, but in the same way that we need to renew and recreate ourselves, organizations need to bring in new blood to maintain their adaptability, creativity, and most important, their fertility. I see myself as a bridge builder in crafting those policies and discussion which will lead KVU into the next needed step and in creating their fertility. This was Yvonne Rivero.
Hey, my name is Sean Biggers, and I'm running for the KVU Board of Directors. The KVU Board of Directors are elected by KVU members, and I want to tell you why I'd be a good fit for the board. So listen close and don't forget to vote. So even though I'm only 21 years old, I have years of experience in community organizing, and I've served on a variety of boards. With each board I've been involved in, I've adopted to a new organizational culture. These experiences would easily translate to KVU. If I'm elected to the KVU board, one of my biggest goals is to make KVU more accessible, relevant, and responsive to young people. I would be an advocate for youth engagement, leadership, and perspective in KVU's programming and governance. I have tons of other things I'd prioritize as well. Some of these include partnerships with schools and other community organizations, more training and team development for the board, and stronger diversity within KVU's leadership. Thanks a lot.
Good morning, good morning, good morning. My name is Abe Proctor. This is KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial. This is Talk Radio, where we talk about, you know, whatever we feel like talking about. Last week was kind of interesting. I don't know if you were listening, but I told our conservative listeners to jump to the front of the line and tell me exactly why we should, you know, back whatever they do at any time and any place ever. And I also asked them to tell us what the Republican Party has ever done that's been in the interest of anybody but the ruling class. So in response, we got a caller, James, who's a regular listener and a regular contributor to the show. And James made a very cogent, very measured argument. You know, he lined up his points. He laid out a clear set of premises and then delivered a conclusion that followed clearly from those premises. His conclusion essentially was, first, if it was up to him, he'd put a bullet in the skull of every terrorist in the world. And secondly, every liberal is a liar and a thief. So I want to thank you, James, for contributing to the show. And we'll welcome you back anytime. And next time, if you'd actually care to bring an argument with you, we'd enjoy that even more. So given that it is election season, and given that we're beginning to see the emergence of every dirty Trovian trick in the book, I would again invite conservatives to call us up, and let's have it out here. Let's decide which way we're all going to fall come November. And also, it just amuses me to hear you guys defend yourselves, because there is no defense. So it makes me look good. Let's call up conservatives and help me look good, please. I need it. Oh, wow, there's a whole lot to talk about. I had a meltdown over the weekend about the fact that our Congress is debating legalizing torture. So just sit back and let that wash over you for a second. The Congress of the United States is debating whether or not to make torture legal. Now, there's another dimension to this whole argument, but I'm going to put the whole torture issue on the back burner for just a moment while I address a couple of other things that are pressing right now. Now, I talked with Kathleen, our AM News and Public Affairs Director, this morning about whether or not it was legal for us to, out of the blue, on the air, dial up a senator or representative's office and question that senator or representative staffers about where that person stands on a particular issue. And that is an open question right now as to whether or not that's legal. So when we find out, we're going to give that a try. And hopefully that will give you guys an idea of what to do in the upcoming weeks, because I think a lot of the issues pending before both houses of Congress right now are going to be swayed in one direction or another by the volume of public opinion that they receive. And indeed, at this late date, and indeed, ever since the election was stolen, the first one, in 2000, really the only thing we have right now is concentrated application of public opinion. So given that it's up in the air right now as to whether or not we can actually make these sorts of cold calls on the air, I will leave you a little bit later with contact information for each of Oregon's five representatives in Congress and both of our senators. So, one of the issues that's been kicking around the blogosphere, I don't know how much of a splash it's made in the mainstream media, I found a couple Associated Press articles about it, is about something called the National Intelligence Estimate. Now, this is something that the intelligence community releases every year. It encompasses the collective judgment of the various federal intelligence agencies, the CIA, the National Security Agency, the intelligence arms of the Pentagon, of the Federal Bureau of Investigation, and so on and so on and so on. Now, if this particular document sounds familiar, it's because it is. The National Intelligence Estimate was used or misused, depending upon your perspective, in the lead-up to the invasion of Iraq. As you recall, a very, very redacted version was finally, grudgingly released to the public by the White House in 2002, in October, I believe it was, after much hemming and hawing on their behalf, saying that they didn't want to compromise intelligence assets in the field, they didn't want to give away sources and personnel or methods or what have you. But really, they didn't want anybody to be able to level any accusations against their case for war. Now, a similar sort of situation is kicking around now. This from the New York Times, September the 24th. A stark assessment of terrorism trends by American intelligence agencies has found that the American invasion and occupation of Iraq has helped spawn a new generation of Islamic radicalism, and that the overall terrorist threat has grown since the September 11th attacks. The report, quote, says that the Iraq war has made the overall terrorism problem worse, end quote, said one American intelligence official. Now, upon hearing this news, I believe the collective reaction from the American public was, duh! Because every idiot who's been paying attention knows that the war on Iraq has done nothing but make the United States less safe. Everybody who's been paying any attention knows that the war in Iraq has done nothing but breed a new generation of terrorists. Every civilian that is killed by an American smart bomb or missile or airstrike or patrol, every one of those people is going to breed five more to spring up in their place. Every kid whose father is killed by the American occupation is going to grow up vowing vengeance on the United States. That's just how it works. I mean, we can tap dance around in an ideological fog in this country about how we're promoting democracy and how we're spreading freedom in the Middle East. But watching your father die at the hands of the Americans, it's going to leave a much more lasting impression than whatever you hear coming out of the talking heads in the White House. Or even if you live in the Mideast, what you see on Al Jazeera News. So it really comes as no surprise, I think, to people who have been paying attention that the war has made us less safe. The war has made increased the volume of resentment against the United States around the world. That the war has made it more likely that ourselves or our allies are going to suffer a catastrophic terror attack. And there's really, we didn't need this report. There were the attacks in Spain. There were the attacks in London. There were the attacks in Bali. All of them directed against members of the so-called coalition of the willing. So, as I mentioned on this show before, it's very easy to get bogged down in rhetorical jousting with conservatives, and it's very easy, and we see it happen all the time. Democrats in Congress falling into various rhetorical traps laid by the right. This election should be about nothing more and nothing less than accountability. Accountability by the administration for its actions domestically and abroad. It's a mess out there. And it's somebody's fault. And we all know whose fault it is. Now, as I mentioned at the outset, every dirty trick in the book is being pulled right now, including attempts to obscure exactly who's at fault for everything that's gone wrong, from the war to the deficit to the terrorist attacks of September 11th to our relative safety from future attacks. All of that's being spun and obscured right now. So if you happen to be a Democratic candidate or a member of Congress and you happen to be listening to my voice right now, you should be focused like a laser on holding these people accountable for what they have done. Nothing more, nothing less. That's what the essence of governance in a democratic republic is. This is what I have done. This is the position that I have maintained. You decide whether or not I have been successful, whether or not those policies have made sense, have made us safer, have made our lives better. And again, if you're a conservative, call me up and tell me how any policy enacted by the Bush administration, domestically or abroad, has made your life better. Unless, of course, you make several million dollars a year, in which case you're a lot richer than you were to begin with. So, the reason that I had wanted to call up representatives' offices this morning is to ask them exactly where they stand on the release of this national intelligence estimate. The White House right now is fighting its release because it is a matter of accountability. If, in fact, the war on terror is making the United States less safe, if, in fact, the occupation of Iraq is actually creating more people who harbor a desire to attack the United States, that would seem to me to be about accountability. Has this war actually made us safer, as the president has claimed? Actually, he claims he wants to have his cake and eat it too. He says, yes, we're safer, but we're not yet safe, you see. We haven't been attacked since 9/11, you see. But it's a very, very dangerous world out there. And, you know, it's a tough times. And how, you know, we're going to continue to do what we need to do to keep America safe. Except to do actually anything that would keep us safe. So your task this week, gentle listeners, is to call up your representative in Congress and call up both of our senators and ask them some questions. First of all, how do you stand, Representative X, on the release of the National Intelligence Estimate? Do you believe that the full text of this document or even a redacted version of the document. Hey, you know, a lot will be made of conservatives about this document, saying that they can't release it because they're going to compromise intelligence assets, blah, 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 blah. It's very easy to release a redacted version of this document that will protect anybody who needs to be protected. Meanwhile, the analytical conclusions drawn in the document can easily be made public. So call up your representatives and say, where do you stand on this? Do you favor this, the release of this document, or don't you? And then call up both senators and ask them the same thing. Now, I'm going to provide you with this information towards the end of the show. And additionally, there's another question you should ask both of our senators, the Honorable Gordon Smith and the Honorable Juan Wyden. You say to them, Senator, if you vote for the torture bill that's going to come out of the Senate Judiciary Committee, if you vote for that bill, you will be lucky to draw 20% in Multnomah County in your next election. If you vote for that bill, you're going to be drummed out of office. That's what they need to know. Accountability, ladies and gentlemen. If you vote for torture, you will not be sent back to office. End of story. Now, Abe, you might ask, is that going to make any difference at all? Well, yeah, it will. Because if enough of us call, enough of us write, enough of us deliver this message, then they're going to listen. They're going to start to worry. Because often the only barometer that these people have of how their constituents are feeling, and more importantly, how their constituents are likely to vote, is what they hear from us. So those of you right now listening from your office, sitting in your cubicle, with the volume turned way down low so your boss can't hear you, hiding under your cloak of progressivism in the corporate workplace, sitting there seething about the war, about torture, about the deficit, about everything else, you know, turn on your computer. Go to Senate.gov. Go to House.gov. All of these people have web forms where you can immediately submit a comment on anything you want to. So do it. Go to Senator Smith. Go to Senator Wyden. Say, if you vote for this thing, if you vote for this disgusting, un-American, undemocratic, immoral thing called torture, regardless of how prettily it's wrapped up or how many bells and whistles and baubles are draped across it, if you vote for this thing, you are not going to be returned to office, period. So do it. It's right there at your fingertips. Your boss won't even notice. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. So far we've been talking about the National Intelligence Estimate document and whether or not it needs to be released to the public in its entirety or even in a redacted form. And we've also touched on the pending torture bill in the Senate Judiciary Committee. And we got James on the phone this morning. Good morning, James. How are you?
Good morning.
Hey, what's going on?
You want me to call you? You wanted me to call up, beat you up again. So I'm going.
No, James, I wanted to give you another shot because you flamed out last week, dude.
Well, you know, you've got your marching orders from the New York Times, which the New York Times has an agenda.
No, no, wait, James, I'm going to stop you right there. I didn't get marching orders from anybody. Go ahead. I quoted you a New York Times article, but that hardly constitutes getting marching orders.
You aren't capable of reasoning and coming to a conclusion through logic and reason on your own. It's obvious that you're told what to think by somebody.
Hmm.
Because it's not, because you don't have any logic behind your conclusions.
Okay. Well, set me straight, James.
I don't know where to begin.
Well, I'd hoped you'd know where to begin, James. You're on the air. Dozens of people are hearing your voice as we speak.
Well, we are safer today than we were before 9/11, and I have evidence, have proof. Under the Clinton administration, when he was playing in the Oval Office with Monica Lewinsky, we had the attack on the World Trade Towers in 93.
Mm-hmm.
We had the attack on Cole.
I think that was before Bill Clinton was having an affair with Monica Lewinsky, just for the record.
We had attack on the Cole. We had attacks on
several what?
The U.S. embassies. We had quite a few terrorist attacks during those years, and since that period of time, the only attacks we've had is on our military in Iraq.
Now, there was, I believe, what was it, the 11th of September 2001, there was a fairly significant attack, and I don't think that Bill Clinton was in office at that time.
I'm talking about since September 11th.
Oh, no, you just said since Bill Clinton's administration.
Well, since September 11th, we have not had the attack. See,
well, wait a minute. There was an attack on the London train system. There was an attack on the train system in Madrid. There was an attack on Australian citizens at a nightclub in Bali. All those nationalities formed part of the coalition of the willing that invaded and occupied Iraq. So how can you say there hasn't been any attacks?
I was referring to the United States of America.
Oh, wait a minute. But these are coalition forces that are conducting this occupation. We're all in this together, says the president. So isn't an attack on one of those just like an attack on us?
The attack on Spain was designed to get that socialist pig elected.
Oh, a socialist pig. So the Al-Qaeda terrorists, who were discovered to have been behind that attack on the Madrid trains, did so to catapult a socialist leader into office?
Yes.
Oh.
And it worked.
Did they call you up and tell you this?
If anybody with any sense can see what happened. It just happened a few weeks before the election. It was designed to frighten the people of Spain, since they're all a bunch of wimps anyway. They're all liberal anyway, so.
Okay, well, let me ask you this. Let me ask you this then, James. Your statement at the beginning here was that there had been no more attacks since September the 11th. Now you've just conceded. You just conceded.
On the United States.
You just conceded that there was an attack on one of our allies in the coalition of the willing, Spain. Now, it doesn't matter why that attack happened. The fact is that it did happen, and it was because Spain was participating in the invasion and occupation of Iraq.
I said that we in the United States have not been attacked since September 11th.
Well, that's not true either. Do you recall the anthrax attacks?
That was never tied to Al-Qaeda.
Oh, well, does it matter? That indeed was a terrorist attack, was it not?
It was probably...
Was that or was that not?
Was
that or was that not an attack upon citizens of the United States?
Well, so was the snipers in Washington, D.C.
Answer my question. Was that or was that not an attack upon the citizens of the United States?
No different than...
okay, well, I'm assuming you're saying yes. I'll assume you're saying yes, that was an attack upon the citizens of the United States. Okay, go ahead, continue.
It was never tied to Al-Qaeda.
Okay. All right, so tell me why we're safer now.
We haven't been attacked.
So the absence of attack indicates our...
It's evidence.
Is evidence of our safety. Okay, and so you're unwilling to concede then that the attacks upon Britain, Spain, and Australia are part of the same global struggle against terrorism. Because the only country that matters in the global struggle against terrorism, I guess, is the United States. Is that correct?
Yes.
Oh, all right then. I imagine the dead people in Madrid and London and Bali might feel differently. But, Diane, that's your opinion, James.
Hey, they're all a bunch of socialists anyway.
Oh, no, they're not. They're part of the coalition of the willing, James. They helped us pull this whole shebang off, man. All right, well, let me read you a quote. This is from retired Major General John Batiste. The conduct of the Iraq War fueled Islamic fundamentalism across the globe and created more enemies for the United States. It says, this is General Batiste, the Iraq conflict, quote, made America arguably less safe now than it was on September 11, 2001, said Batiste, who commanded the 1st Infantry Division in Iraq, 2004 to 2005. I don't know. Does his opinion carry any weight with you?
He's probably a Democrat, and he's got a political axe to grind.
Okay, well, he's also a commissioned officer in the United States Army who commanded an infantry division on the ground in Iraq, telling you and me that that war has made us less safe. Now, your response to me is to name his probable political affiliation, in your opinion?
Yeah.
Okay.
He's probably a closet Nazi.
Oh, I see. Okay. Hey, James, I got to tell you, man. You're going to have to do better, dude. Continue.
Well, it's hard to communicate with somebody who's got their head up their orifice.
Okay, thank you for that. James, ladies and gentlemen. James, I'm going to keep giving you a shot every week, dude. And until you can actually pull off an argument without degrading into attacks either upon me or immediate assumptions drawn out of thin air about somebody's political affiliation, I'm going to keep giving you a shot until you can actually string an argument together from beginning to end. I suspect that you can't. But in the interest of fairness, I'm going to keep giving you a shot. And also, I find it very entertaining. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Ron, good morning.
Good morning.
How are you?
Oh, well, I'm okay. I don't like to bring up crosstalk, but this guy, you know, I get tired of all the time that you spend pandering to this cretin.
I know. It is a little self-indulgent. I'm sorry.
Fool, and you spend too much time talking to him. You practically got star status. James, you know?
Yeah, I know.
I don't know anybody as stupid and as wrong-headed as this guy. So please don't give him so much damn time. Thank you.
You're welcome. Well, I'm going to give James at least one more shot. Not today. I just have too much fun. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. Jeff, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning, Abraham. How are you?
I'm well. And yourself, sir?
Oh, I'm good, and from my listening post here in North Portland, you're on fire, and I love my brother James, even though he needs to be corrected on several
things.
Yeah,
I love James,
too. The cities
too.
Are Dar es Salaam and Nairobi, Kenya, and
Tanzania.
Ethiopia. No, not Ethiopia.
Tanzania.
Dar es Salaam is in
Tanzania.
Tanzania, that's
yeah.
It. Mr. Clinton did a fine job, I must say, even though I am still repelled by his public lies and his grand jury lies, and I'm with James on that one, just on his personal morality and how it really took us into and the reactions of the right wing took us down a sewer tour. But Mr. Clinton was on Sunday's television show.
Yes, he was.
Up against Chris Matthews, interestingly.
Chris Wallace,
yes. I'm sorry. Who is, interestingly enough, the son of Mike Wallace. Which kind of makes it even more perverse and weird.
Yeah, proud day for the Wallaces.
But he stuck it to him, and he did a fine job, and Mr. Clinton indicated very clearly, I went after these guys, I failed, I regret that. And then he said 8 or 9 months, indicating between the time that Mr. Our dear leader was installed and inaugurated to the September 11th attacks, there was nothing done. And Mr. Clinton made that clear, and I think Dick Clark's book made that clear, and I think anybody who thinks otherwise is itching for a fight. But anyway, Dar es Salaam and Nairobi were where those
right.
awful bombings were. And when James indeed has, when James or his, or any people like this that grab onto that hook, line, and sinker and swallow it whole, when they're prepared with information, with knowledge, with real facts, then there is an argument to be made. And you're right in saying that almost, I'm not going to pick on my brother, but the mass of these people simply accept this and digest it, kind of digest it, and don't even think about it. And when your brain is disengaged and you're not studying and researching, as you, Abe, do so very well, well, then you have absolutely no foundation to make an argument on, and that's all I can say. And I thank you for taking my call. I love you.
Oh, I love you, too. Thanks for the call. 231-8187 is the number to call. Join the love in this morning. Feel the love coming out of your radio. I'm glad that last caller brought up President Clinton's interview over the weekend, because that was, as a matter of fact, next on my list. Now, okay, we've been back and forth over the subject of Bill Clinton on this show ad nauseum over the years. Whether or not you're a fan of Bill Clinton's politics or of his personal conduct is immaterial, I think, when you measure the man's sheer political and oratory gifts. Bill Clinton was absolutely a towering figure in American politics, one of the finest orators of the last part of the 20th century, and really, I think, a consummate politician. So he was on Chris Wallace's show on Fox News, and Wallace came after him with the GOP party line and attempted to draw a connection between the withdrawal from Somalia under Bill Clinton's administration and future terrorist attacks on the United States, September 11th by implication. The argument was that the withdrawal that was made there emboldened the terrorists to strike at us in the future. Now, Clinton proceeded to absolutely dismember that argument, first of all, and secondly, to dismember Wallace and the right-wing media hit machine as well. And you can watch this this interview in its entirety at www.crooksandliars.com, and you can watch the relevant section of the interview at www.salon.com. Now, Salon's got a membership section, but I think if they'll give you the option of sitting through a brief advertisement, during which time you can get up from your computer and go fix yourself a cup of coffee and come back, and then it'll be over and you can watch the interview. I would definitely recommend giving it a watch. It is a textbook example of how to deconstruct the conservative noise machine. So the thrust of Clinton's argument was this. First of all, there is no connection to be drawn between the situation in Somalia and the September 11th attacks and the subsequent terrorist attacks against our allies. Further, he goes back and actually sheds light upon the reality of the situation at the time. And if you'll recall, there was a universal conservative chorus in the halls of Congress calling for the United States to withdraw from Somalia, that we had no business doing there, it wasn't worth any more American lives, and that it was a big, fat, wet, soppy, liberal nation-building mistake. But Clinton didn't heed those calls for immediate withdrawal. He stuck around and helped oversee an orderly transition of control to the United Nations in Somalia. Now, Somalia has been far from orderly since then, and this is not, again, to place a false halo upon the head of Bill Clinton. It's merely to bring in that annoying specter of reality into the midst of right-wing spin. So Clinton deconstructed that argument and then went on to say, hey, Chris Wallace, you're just doing a right-wing hit job on me. I'm on Fox News, and I want to know, are you asking these same questions to anyone from the Bush administration? Are you asking anyone from the Bush administration, did you do enough to prevent a terrorist attack? Did you do enough to get bin Laden? And Clinton admitted that he didn't get bin Laden, so no, he didn't do enough. But he went on to categorically make the case that he did far, far more to go after Osama bin Laden than anything that anyone in the Bush administration has done since. He got closer to getting him than anyone has before or since. And then went on to make the quite factual and quite correct claim that in the 8 months before between President Bush's inauguration and the September 11th attacks, they did virtually nothing to get Osama bin Laden, despite being left a comprehensive dossier on the man and his organization, and despite having probably the best qualified man in the world, Richard Clark, as head of counterterrorism operations. So Bill Clinton asked some very pertinent questions, like, how come you're not asking Fox News? How come you're not asking the Bush administration why they fired Richard Clark? How come you're not asking the Bush administration why they did nothing? How come you're not asking them the very same questions you're asking me? So it was a brilliant, brilliant display, both de-spinning both the argument, attempting to falsely connect the Somalia situation with the September 11th attacks, and also brilliantly deconstructing the whole methodology of the right-wing media spin machine. So give it a watch. Regardless of how you feel about Bill Clinton, it's a pretty impressive display by a master politician. So today, Secretary of State Condoleezza Rice rebutted the president. Here's what she said in today's New York Post, owned, incidentally, by Rupert Murdoch, owner of Fox News Corporation. Here's Condi. Quote, what we did in the 8 months was at least as aggressive as what the Clinton administration did in the preceding years, Rice said Monday during a meeting with editors and reporters at the New York Post. Now, let's see. What did they do in those 8 months? Let's see. What did they do? But they didn't do anything. Nothing. Clinton went after this dude. Lobbed cruise missiles at him. Did so despite a howling right-wing chorus saying, no blood for Monica, wag the dog, this is the president trying to delay his own impeachment. Now, we're leaving aside right now the question of the morality of lobbing cruise missiles to go after a terrorist leader. Let's leave that rather stinky pile open on the table for just a moment. The fact remains, Bill Clinton administration was far more focused on the problem of Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda than the Bush administration was. We all know the story about the presidential daily briefing that said bin Laden determined to strike inside the United States. We all know they did nothing. As we discussed in some detail on this program 3 weeks ago, it looks pretty apparent that they intentionally did nothing. But again, that's another story. So go give that a look, crooksandliars.com or salon.com. And watch the master at work. 231-8187 is the number to call. Jack, good morning.
Abe. Yeah. As to whether anybody likes or dislikes Clinton any better than Bush or whatever, I'd just suggest that, you know, the dog's been wagged for quite a while, and Osama has been a CIA operative since way back in Mujahideen days. Okay.
I don't know if that's technically.
It shows that you are trying to get after the bad guy, and of course we got to keep the bad guy bad. You know, rather than checking out the stuff at salon.com, I'd recommend people go to 911truth.org and check stuff out there. Am I still on?
Yep, you're still on.
Okay, good. You know, the point about this stuff, I know that you and a lot of the other people around prefer the blowback position and the lie hop position. You know what that is, right?
Why don't you elaborate for the sake of argument?
That's the when it comes to the 9/11 truth issue, there's two arguments. One is let it happen on purpose. The other is made it happen on purpose. The lie hop position. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the people that, in my opinion, who have the most insightful analysis of this are not the so-called left gatekeepers, the Chomskys, the Gore Vidals, you know, Michael Moore. These people who seem to be just absolutely scared to death of stepping up to the 9/11 truth issue for fear of being labeled so-called wacko conspiracy theorists. Okay.
Now, hang on, just a minute, Jack. Listen, I don't.
Yeah.
This discussion is not about 9/11 conspiracies or what happened that day. This discussion.
I know you're talking about Bill Clinton.
Yeah, well, I'm talking about Bill Clinton in the context of the obfuscation that's coming out of Washington right now in advance of the November elections.
Well, the obfuscation out of Washington never seems to stop.
Yeah, that's absolutely
the point
true.
I'm making.
That's absolutely true. But I don't want to get into an aside about, you know, what happened on September 11th. We covered that in exhaustive detail a few weeks ago.
Since then, of course, is this horrific war. Okay, we're on the verge of World War III, and the false flag terror does not let up. We've had Madrid. We've had 7/7 bombing in London, which has been exposed as a false flag operation. The liquid bomb operation has been exposed now as false flag, and you can expect more. And I would just say this to all your listeners, and then I'll get off. Take the advice of Webster G. Tarpley. If WMD goes off anywhere in the world, do not look to the cave, do not look to bin Laden, do not look to his laptop, look to Cheney and Cheney's handlers, okay? That's it, you know?
Well said. Okay. Amen to that. That was a good call. Now, I don't want to, as I just said, I don't want to get in again to what happened on September the 11th. My point in bringing up Bill Clinton was that there is an attempt going on right now to link the withdrawal from Somalia to future terrorist attacks on the United States. And, of course, there is no link to be drawn there. And there's also an attempt to criticize the Clinton administration's efforts to disrupt the Al-Qaeda network and to kill or capture Osama bin Laden, and what the Bush administration didn't do to do either of those things. Now, there's some very salient facts on the board. First of all, there really is no comparison between the two administrations when it comes to actually attempting to disrupt the Al-Qaeda network and its activities and to kill and or capture Osama bin Laden. One administration tried to do so, the other did not. It is as simple as that. James brought up the 1993 bombing of the World Trade Center towers in New York. That's when a truck full of explosives detonated in the basement parking structure of the building. The building, of course, remained intact. Now, everybody involved with that plot was brought to trial and imprisoned and is still in jail. And it was the attention, the information unearthed in that process that gave to Bill Clinton the impetus to go after Osama bin Laden and Al-Qaeda. Because here was a guy who I think quite rightly said to himself, wow, these guys just tried to take down a major American landmark with a terrorist attack. And by golly, they might try to do it again. I'm going to try to get this guy. And he did, and he very nearly succeeded. Now, you compare that, and I think we can accurately classify that as proactive attempts to get rid of Osama and Al-Qaeda. We can call that proactive action. That might be redundant, proactive action. Anyway, but the Bush administration didn't do anything. So that's really a night and day comparison. And any attempt by Condoleezza Rice or anybody else to say differently is a lie. It is a lie for Condi to say what we did in the 8 months was at least as aggressive as what the Clinton administration did in the preceding years. That is a lie. And don't believe it. And is it a coincidence that it's coming out on another Fox News organ like the New York Post? No, I don't think that it is. But again, don't take my word for it. Crooksandliars.com, Salon.com. Watch the Bill Clinton interview with Chris Wallace. 231-8187 is the number to call. This is Talk Radio. I'm Abe Proctor. You are listening to KBOO 90.7 FM. Dave, good morning.
Yes, hi. This is Dave. I'm a proud conservative.
Okay.
I call myself a conservative more so than a Republican. I'd like to concede a couple of things I think that we could agree on. And one of them is, the war in Iraq was probably not the best idea. I think the resources to be used should have been better used in Afghanistan. Can we agree to that?
Yeah, okay, I'm with you so far.
And then I think that we could probably both agree that Clinton and Bush Jr. probably haven't done what they could have, especially with Clinton. I think he didn't have the political ability to do what he could have done because there wasn't the 9/11 attack.
Well, okay. I'm sort of with you there. Clinton didn't, just a second, let me make a point and I'll let you continue. Clinton didn't have the political atmosphere to do what he needed to do because he was being hounded over
Correct.
A personal affair. Okay, go ahead.
That, and I think the public wouldn't understand what the situation was. They weren't educated on how bad the situation really was.
Yeah, I think you're right about that too.
And I think this is where I'd like to see if we can have some agreement, which I think is really the big problem, is treating terrorism as a crime and not as a war issue.
Okay, go on.
Well, I think it should be a war issue, and I think if America really wants to fight terrorism, they should spend their time and energy in a war atmosphere, which means using all resources of the United States government to stamp out terrorism.
So you believe then that the war on fighting a war against global terrorism and terrorists is the right approach and one that will ultimately bring about an end?
Well, I think
to that
if you look at the situation, it's kind of like they're using political power, political reasoning to try to fight us because they can't fight us on the battlefield.
No, that's absolutely true. There isn't a conventional military in the world that can take on the United States.
So, having said that, if you look back in history and throughout the history of mankind, these kinds of things, you either kill them or you lose.
Yeah, I wouldn't agree. What would you say about Vietnam? Vietnam is analogous to the occupation of Iraq in that we faced an implacable guerrilla enemy that grew stronger the longer
right.
the occupation went on.
Absolutely correct. I mean, my dad served three tours in Vietnam, and he was a Marine, and he would tell you the reason why we lost is because we were not committed to win that war.
Now, I would have to disagree with you again. The reason we lost is that it is impossible to defeat an intractable guerrilla foe over the long term.
Well, it depends on, I mean, you look at, we fought some really seriously tough battles that were guerrilla battles in the past. The Japanese were really tough opponents to fight, but we did win decisively and quickly, and it was because we used just all assets of our ability to win that war.
Yes.
I think it really comes down to how much punishment do we want to take before we have to take that action.
Hmm.
Because we had to get attacked, you know, obviously in Hawaii in order to do that. And if you look at Roosevelt, who was a great president, he really didn't want to go to war in the European theater. And it was all the way up until the very last moment that he decided to go because he thought it would still work out. And I think it just comes to, you know, it just depends. I mean, the Republicans and Democrats, they're going to fight and fight and fight until it just becomes pretty apparent that they have to get their act together and work together to win this war. Otherwise, we're going to lose the democracy that we have.
Yeah, I'd have to agree with you there.
But I think really the problem is in America, I think we all get hung up on, oh, he's a Democrat, he's a Republican. I'm a proud conservative. That just means I like to spend less money in government. And I think people should have a little more responsibility with what they do with their lives. But that doesn't mean we aren't all Americans. And then when we're faced with a real serious issue like terrorism, that we shouldn't face it together and do what it takes to win the war. And we can all sit down and decide, you know, what's the best tack to do that. But until the day comes when we say, okay, you know, depending on whichever aisle you're on, it doesn't matter at this point. We need to figure out what is the. There's a lot of smart people out there. We can ask the smart people what to do and say, let's go for it, and you have all resources available to you, and this is what we have to do.
Yeah, I agree with you that we all are Americans, and we all face this situation together. So based on what you just told me, I would conclude that you would oppose, then, those voices, the demonization of those voices who have questioned the administration's tack in this war. If you oppose the war, especially early on, you were labeled as unpatriotic, as un-American, as cowardly, and it sounds to me like you have a more reasoned approach to that, and you would tolerate and even encourage that sort of dissent and discussion. Is that right?
I do agree with that. I think early on, you know, it was confusing as an American not having privy to all the information because, you know, you're told what's going on the news. So, you know, as a proud American, if that's what we have to do, that's probably in line where I was. But as the war goes on, you start figuring all this stuff out. You're thinking, was our resources really used in the best way? And if we would have taken, you know, I like Bush Sr. in the fact that he dropped 500,000 guys in Iraq, and it was a decisive and total obvious, you know, win for the Americans. If we had done something like that just in Afghanistan and turned that place around within a quick amount of time using a lot less money, a lot less resources, we would have put a lot more fear into the Muslim radicals.
That's true, and we also might have actually lent some credence to the premise that we're actually trying to spread democracy and freedom in the region.
Absolutely, absolutely, and we would have put a lot more fear into the bad guys if we would have taken a much smaller task and overwhelmingly won, and just, you know, speak quietly and carry a big stick. I think that's the first Roosevelt who did a great job too.
All right, hey, well, thank you for the call, man.
Thank you.
I appreciate it. See, James, it's not that hard. I mean, I didn't agree with everything that last caller had to say, but it was presented in a reasonable manner. There were historical analogies drawn, and he didn't once call me or any other liberal a name. So that's how it's done, James. Better luck next time. I want to address a few points from that call. some of them are small, some of them are a little more relevant. The small one first, the fight against Japan in the Second World War was not a guerrilla struggle. We fought a conventional Japanese military that was itself occupying territory that it had claimed by conquest. Secondly, the reason we failed to win the Vietnam War was not because there was a lack of commitment of resources, troops, and material. That's simply not the case. The war in Vietnam was lost because we faced an intractable guerrilla foe defending its own territory against an occupying force. And that is ultimately an unwinnable situation. That's the lesson that we should have carried into the war in Iraq, because that also is an ultimately unwinnable situation, regardless of how many troops, how many machines, how many bullets we ship in there. We cannot win against a foe who is willing to resist occupation at all costs. The harder we clamp down, the more they will fight back. And ultimately, as Nietzsche says about staring into the abyss stares back at you. So in attempting to maintain an occupation in a situation like that, we become that which we despise. And that, in my opinion, is the biggest danger in the war on terrorism. And we've seen this overtly as well. We have people like the vice president openly saying that we're going to have to operate on the dark side, that we're going to have to do things we wouldn't necessarily like. And that's the danger. I mean, there's a danger when you fight a war of any kind, conventional or otherwise, guerrilla or some amorphous whatever this is we're doing now against an ism like terrorism. War always brings out the darkest impulses of humanity. There are always atrocities that are committed. We always become less than what we might be. All glorification of honor and valor and duty, all of that aside, war lessens all of us, especially the people who are actually fighting it. And I think that's doubly true of a struggle like this one. When we're talking about a foe, it's hard to even discuss it in these terms. When we're talking about people who are willing to use tactics like suicide bombings, like flying planes into buildings, like all these things that we've been talking about for months and months and months, I think it becomes easier to resort to similar kinds of methods. It becomes easier to torture detainees. When you stare into the abyss long enough, pretty soon it stares back at you. And it cheapens all of us. It cheapens all of humanity. What the United States has been doing is a black mark against everyone. So I don't think that this struggle, this war, whatever you want to call it, is going to be resolved by the commitment of more money, of more troops, of more weapons of war. The only way this is going to be resolved is in a reasonable fashion. There's no justification for flying airplanes into buildings and killing thousands of people. There's no justification for strapping a bomb to your chest and having it blow up on a bus. There's no justification for anything that's happened in this struggle. None. But nevertheless, the September 11th attacks, which are the ideological touchstone for everything that has come after, let's face it. The September 11th attacks didn't happen in a vacuum, as the president would have us believe. They don't hate us for our freedom. They attacked because of long-standing resentment fueled by American foreign policy decisions. And as I just said, regardless of how angry the Muslim world may be about the way the United States has conducted itself, both in terms of propping up oppressive regimes in the region like Saudi Arabia, in participating in the subjugation of a native people as happening in Palestine, in maintaining permanent military installations in the Holy Land of Saudi Arabia, in dominating the petropolitics of the region for decades. None of that resentment justifies attacks like those that happened on September 11th. But those are grievances. Those are legitimate grievances that deserve to be aired. And until that happens, there's no end in sight. And if we continue to occupy a Muslim country, you forget it. Forget it. All bets are off. Nothing. There's no progress, no quote-unquote victory, whatever that might mean, is within reach as long as we're there. Period. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. This is Talk Radio. Lewis, good morning.
Hi. Until the conclusions about victory factors in the losses to civilian society and civilians and gets away from how many combatants are killed, it's a specious argument. The whole idea of who wins and who loses should be factored with the losses of civilians and who makes money.
And oh, absolutely.
In that sense, the United States war machine won, and the arms manufacturers around the world won. They won, regardless of what flag they represented, they won the war in Vietnam, and that's the way it's always been. The real losers, of course, were the civilian Cambodians, Thailand people, the Vietnamese. But the real reason I called is I want to ask you and your listeners, are the contractors in Iraq, our contractors, our mercenaries, mm-hmm. are they illegal combatants? And
that's
therefore
a very good question.
Can be subjected to treatment that is an abridgment of the Geneva Accords. And also, how about the over 30,000 service people in the U.S. military who are not citizens? Are they illegal combatants? I'd like to ask that question and raise that as an issue to be discussed on your program, because we were talking about the illegal combatants as defined by the Bush administration. It seems like all those are relevant points since we're deciding here what is permissible in terms of abridging the Geneva Accords with their treatment of them once they're captured. So thank you.
Thank you, Lewis. That's a very interesting question. I hadn't even considered that. Are mercenaries, by their very definition, unlawful combatants? Would the same disregard for the Geneva Convention with which the Bush administration treats captured detainees in this struggle, would that same disregard apply to mercenaries fighting in the service of the United States that happen to be captured by somebody on the other side? I would tend to think that it does. That's a very, very good question, Lewis. I'm glad you brought that up. I'm going to have to research that. 503-231-8187 is the number to call. All right, I'm going to take an information timeout. As I mentioned before, there's work to be done, folks. Work to be done. Public opinion needs to rain down upon your elective representatives like manna from heaven. So, here's some contact information. Representative Earl Blumenauer, Portland phone number 503-231-2300, Washington, D.C., 202-225-4811. And I will give these again at the end of the show. David Wu, Portland number 503-326-2901, Washington, D.C., 202-225-0855. Greg Walden, Medford office, 541-776-4646, D.C., 202-225-6730. Darlene Hooley, West Lynn office, 503-557-1234, D.C., 202-225-5711. Peter DeFazio, Eugene, 541-465-6732, D.C., 202-225-6416. Those are Oregon's five members of the House of Representatives. I want you to call them. I want you to email them and ask them, where do they stand on the release of the National Intelligence Estimate document? And also ask them what they believe its relevance is in holding the administration accountable for its actions. United States Senators, Gordon Smith, Portland office, 503-326-3386, D.C. office, 202-224-3753. Ron Wyden, Portland office, 503-326-7525, D.C. office, 202-224-5244. Those senators need to hear that very same question about the National Intelligence Estimate document, also about the accountability of the administration. And in addition, they need to receive one very loud and clear message, and that is, if you vote for the torture bill abomination, that it is inevitably on its way out of the Senate Judiciary Committee, then you will be lucky to get 20% in the Tri-County area, and you will in all likelihood not go back to office. Speaking of accountability, they have to be accountable to us. And I don't know about you, but nobody who votes for torture is going to get my vote in this lifetime or in any other. You're listening to KBOO 90.7 FM, 231-8187. Gordon, good morning.
Good morning.
How you doing?
Oh, sorry. So I was, I've been watching, and I was listening to a little bit earlier about Bill Clinton, and, mm-hmm. and boy, I'll tell you, Clinton really, he sold us out on the import-exports.
Yeah, he did.
And, you know, we really jumped up in exports when that happened. And we went from, like, it was just huge numbers. So he basically sold off our country for money, basically, to help our economy. But at the same time, it really hurt us in the long run. But, you know, all this war is this Afghanistan war, this Iraqi war, you know, this all has to do with the money and the oil. And it really, you have to go way, way back to the end of World War One, and you have to go into World War Two, and Japan, they were really wanting a lot of oil and wanting that Indonesia, the pass, the strait there through Indonesia.
Uh-huh.
And that whole Hawaii deal was a facade to keep our eyes off of what was going on in Indonesia and stuff. But also, you know, the Afghanistan, my wife's brother was in Afghanistan, and he said that they're bombing a straight line, and our government's actually using our military to bomb pipeline trenches through the Afghan mountains. And he said that they're only bombing a certain part of the country where the pipeline's going, and the rest of the country is completely, they don't give a crap.
You know, see, so, I don't know if that's true, but
that's what her brother said, and he's a major right-wing Republican.
He's
a hardcore right-winger, man.
Past events would lead me to think it might very well be true. I'll address that when you're
He's a hardcore right-winger, and he said that, you know, they're just wasting money, and what they're doing is they're bombing a line over to the sea. And also that Hitler deal, he was in Russia for oil in World War II. It all started during World War II, the oil wars. And
before that even.
Uh-huh.
Before that even.
Of course. I mean, well, you can't have what we have without it. And look at China. They want what we have, and it's almost over. And they're actually speeding up the end. And it's really concerning. And you know, Carter said back in the early 70s, Carter said, we will use everything in our power to defend the Middle East. That is our interest, and
yes,
we will use all might to defend it.
Yeah, thank
and
you
that's
much.
Where the World War III is going to be. That's where it's at.
Agreed. Hey, thank you for the call, Gordon.
So, yeah.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah, there is no ignoring, in the final analysis, the geopolitics of petroleum in the region. Suffice it to say that if there wasn't any oil underneath Iraq, we wouldn't be there. Because I think we proved beyond a shadow of a doubt that there was, has nothing whatsoever to do, Iraq had nothing to do with September 11th attacks, has nothing, no relationship, tangential or otherwise, to the so-called war on terror. And there's one reason and one reason only that we're there in the final analysis. So thank you, Gordon, for bringing us back to that salient fact. Now I want to get to this torture issue again before the end of the day. This from the blog Orcinus, O-R-C-I-N-U-S. This is David Newert. The baseline problem with torture, after all, is that it is immoral on its face, a violation not of the golden rule or not just of the Golden Rule and basic Christian precepts, but of nearly any system of ethics. Even the most hard-nosed rationalist will come to this conclusion. See, for example, Kant's categorical imperative. It's an obvious one if you're a Christian. All you have to present to any Christian when it comes to torture is their own favorite moral guidepost aphorism. What would Jesus do? To anyone familiar not just with Jesus' teachings, but the story of his martyrdom, including his torture at the hands of authorities, the answer is crystal clear. Exactly. Torture is unacceptable and immoral behavior. It is not for nothing that Bush and Cheney are going to exceptional lengths to hide what they're doing to people right now and what they've done in the past. And that really, I think, puts the finger right on it. You can argue till you're blue in the face that information garnered under torture is effective, and I think that has also been proved beyond a shadow of a doubt to be false. People will say anything when they're being tortured just to make it stop. But torture, on its face, is immoral and uncivilized and should have nothing whatsoever to do with a democratic republic such as our own. The fact that it is a blight upon the history of this country and should be cause for every American to rise up and denounce it. The United States Senate and the United States House of Representatives are debating whether or not to make this sort of thing legal. And as Mr. Newark points out, they're going to great lengths, semantic and otherwise, to hide what they've been doing. To call it coercive interrogation. To use a whole bunch of nice-sounding new euphemisms to dress up what is torture. Torture is what it is. It is immoral. It is unacceptable to anybody who calls themselves a citizen of a civilized nation. As human beings, it is unacceptable. In any system of ethics, and under any code of morals, under any system of belief, secular or sacred, anywhere in the world, it is unacceptable. People who do it are denounced historically as criminals. People who do it on a large enough scale are tried as war criminals. Now, one thing that this administration is trying to do, and one thing that they may or may not have successfully brokered with that so-called compromise struck between the White House and three Republican senators last week, what they're trying to do, in addition to legalizing the abominations that they have been practicing in this so-called war on terror, is to immunize themselves from any future prosecution as war criminals. They are trying to retroactively amend the War Crimes Act. So that really tells you all you need to know. They know what they're doing is wrong. If it wasn't wrong, they wouldn't be trying to hide it. If it wasn't wrong, they wouldn't be taking steps to immunize themselves from prosecution. This is from an op-ed in the Chicago Sun-Times from former New York Representative Elizabeth Holtzman. 32 years ago, President Gerald Ford created a political firestorm by pardoning former President Richard Nixon of all crimes he may have committed in Watergate. Now, President Bush, to avoid a similar public outcry, is quietly trying to pardon himself of any crimes connected with the torture and mistreatment of U.S. detainees. The pardon is buried in Bush's proposed legislation to create a new kind of military tribunal for cases involving top al-Qaeda operatives. The pardon provision has nothing to do with the tribunals. Instead, it guts the War Crimes Act of 1996, a federal law that makes it a crime, in some cases punishable by death, to mistreat detainees in violation of the Geneva Conventions, and makes the new, weaker terms of the War Crimes Act retroactive to September the 11th, 2001. This is what our fearless leader is attempting to do. He's attempting to make it legal to torture enemy combatants, anyone he determines by his own judgment to be an enemy combatant. And he's immunizing himself and his agents from any accountability for it. Now, this should turn the stomach of anyone who calls themselves an American. In fact, anyone who calls themselves a human being. And that's why I read off to you that list of phone numbers a little while ago. Your representatives in Congress need to know that their political careers are over if they support this. And don't even get me started about the so-called opposition party. If any Democrat votes for this, they should be tossed out on the street. I'm sure we know what to expect from the Republicans, because they sold their souls a long time ago. But now it's time to put up or shut up, Democrats. When this comes to the floor of the Senate for a vote, every Democratic senator should get up and walk out. Walk out. If the Republicans want to pass this, if the Republicans want to go down as the Congress that legitimized torture, then let them do it by themselves. You listening, Senator Wyden? If you vote for this thing, you're done, man. You are done. The same with you, Senator Smith. The time for redemption has not yet passed you by, Democrats. But if you go down this road, forget it. Forget it. 231-8187. Nick, you're next. Good morning. Lack.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Congratulations on addressing that specious comparison with Japan earlier on. I'm a bit of a World War II buff, and I find that there have been a lot of comparisons drawn between Iraq and World War II that are really quite quite illogical if one knows anything about knows a bit about World War II.
And insulting.
Well, yeah, that too. But I just wanted to address a couple of things. That conservative was on saying talking about treating terrorism as a war as opposed to a criminal action. I find that an interesting argument, but it seems to me that there are any number of conditions that kill a lot more Americans every year than terrorists, illegal drugs being one, for example.
Legal drugs being another.
Well, both, but it's certainly illegal drugs,
right,
at least anyways. So, I mean, if you know, it seems to me that if one is going to address American concerns, one should really try to do something effective about the drug problem as opposed to going out and invading other countries and killing thousands of people.
Yeah, but it's just
and
not
there
as
seems to be a lack of will to do that.
It's just not as sexy as barbarians at the gate.
Obviously,
know?
Yeah, yeah. The other thing was the point that that other chap raised about whether contractors and people serving in the military who aren't U.S. citizens are illegal combatants. I don't know about the contractors, but I'm pretty sure that these non-citizens in the U.S. military are legal combatants, because, again, there's a long history of that. There are a lot of Poles, for example, in the British forces during World War II, and the Germans, for the most part, treated them as legal combatants. A lot of them got shot down in Bomber Command and ended up in prison camps, so I think those ones are probably legal. The contractors,
yeah,
I don't know.
I tend to agree.
That's it.
Hi, hey, thank you very much, Lex, for the call. Yeah, I think if somebody is wearing the uniform of the United States military, is part of the command structure, is receiving pay as a United States soldier and all that, I think it'd be a stretch to define them as an illegal combatant, which is not to say that somebody won't. This just in. Coming up this morning on KBOO. At 9 on Between the Covers, the guest is Lisa Tucker, author of Once Upon a Day, a novel about how a single day can change the course of our lives. At 9:30 on Words and Pictures, the guest is groundbreaking cartoonist Sherry Flanagan, who started her underground career with the infamous satirical group Air Pirates and became best known for her National Lampoon comic strip Trots and Bonnie. At 10, local activist Patricia Barrera will honor the memory of feminist activist and author Andrea Dworkin on her birthday. We'll hear excerpts of a talk she gave in Portland over 20 years ago. And at 10:30, on stage and studio, guest host Emily Young welcomes Olga Sanchez, director, and Joanne Farias, playwright for Road to Xibalba at Miracle Theater. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, an Army medic and his wife are interviewed. Later today, the medic plans to turn himself into the military weeks after he went AWOL at his base in Germany. And the mayor of Salt Lake City, Rocky Anderson, discusses why he spoke out recently at a protest against President Bush and the Iraq War. All that and more coming up today on your community radio station, 90.7 FM. This is Talk Radio. 231-8187 is the number to call. We're talking about terrorism. We are talking about the need to release the National Intelligence Estimate document and its role in proving the accountability of the administration for its actions. We are talking about the storm of spin coming out of the right-wing media machine in Washington in advance of the November elections. And we've gone into a few examples of that. So all that and more is, of course, on the table. 231-8187 is the number to call. Whom do we have? John, good morning.
Yeah, good morning. Am I on the air?
Yes.
Yeah, this is Sean here.
Go ahead. Sean, excuse me.
Yeah, no, I just thought, you know, we were here in the U.S. by September 11th, what happened, and rightfully so. 3,000 or so, you know, innocent people were killed. I think we need to look at since that, every month in Iraq, we are causing the equivalent of a 9/11 every month in Iraq. Maybe not directly, but indirectly, we are responsible for what's happening there. Think about how the whole Muslim world is looking at us. Here we went into this country that had nothing to do with 9/11, and right now that country is destroyed, and we are causing the equivalent of a 9/11 every month in that country to innocent people, and indirectly we are responsible for that. So what I want people to do is think about that, and the other thing is, I've lost my train of thought here, but anyway, if I'm calling
you
or sorry, go ahead.
No, you're doing fine. Go on.
What I want to say is think about the amount of terrorism or new terrorists that we are generating because of that. You know, think of the anger that we had over 9/11 and just think of the anger that we're generating over what we are doing over there. And I just want people to, if people would just think about that and instead of looking at this as a so-called, I like the way you use so-called because it's not a war on terrorism. If we had treated 9/11 like something criminal, we had all the world behind us. If we had gone after those people specifically involved in it, instead of this stupid so-called war, we would be much further ahead. I don't know where we go from here because it's just sort of scary where we've got ourselves into. But we just need a change. And take any of your response up here. Thanks.
All right. Amen, brother. You nailed it. And that's exactly what the National Intelligence Estimate says. The war on Iraq is making us less safe because it's producing more and more people who hate us sufficiently to reach out and inflict harm against us. And as I said, the response from the American public was, well, duh! Yeah, I mean, he's absolutely right. Every month, we are perpetrating the equivalent of a September 11th attack upon the Iraqi people. Tens of thousands of civilians, women, children, have died in their homes, in their beds, as a result of this occupation. The country has degenerated into civil war, secular conflict, which was largely suppressed during the years of Saddam Hussein's rule, have bubbled over. The neighboring Shiite nation of Iran is by proxy extending its influence throughout the region. Anti-Americanism is higher than it's ever been in the Muslim world. And all of it, there is a direct cause and effect relationship between this invasion and occupation and the level of hatred against the United States that exists today. We're absolutely less safe than we were. We're absolutely in more danger than we were. It's less safe to travel abroad now as an American than it was before. We are less free here in the United States than we were before. Sometimes I wonder when I woke up in a dystopian sci-fi novel. Do you ever feel that way? It's like an episode of The Twilight Zone. It's like a Philip K. Dick book. 231-8187 is the number to call. Tom, good morning.
And there's one more connection you neglected to mention with respect to the Muslim attitude toward the United States of America, and something that's new. And that is spelled out, I think, quite well in, if I do say so myself, GOPbias.com. And that's the connection with Israel. There's a book, it's been out since 2004. The title of the book is A Pretext for War. The author of the book is James Bamford. Mr. Bamford is the most respected expert on the CIA and intelligence services. in the last 20 years. And Mr. Bamford details the ways in which the beginning of this war, and incidentally, that man who was criticizing Bill Clinton, Bill Clinton resisted the strong pressure of the Israeli lobby in these United States, AIPAC, and there's the Anti-Defamation League, they've got
right.
this, that, and the other thing. And Mr. Clinton, as he didn't get to it on the Chris Wallace show, but he resisted the efforts of Jewish Americans to force us into this war against Iraq. It was a welcome. It was welcomed by George Bush. And I think we have to remember that. Now, I know it's
Tom,
a touchy subject.
Tom, Jewish Americans did not force us into this war with Iraq.
Well, you might read Mr. Bamford's book and ask just how it came about. And incidentally, you don't have to read the whole book. All you have to read is about pages 290 to 320, and he spells out the connection. I mean, it was there. Mr. Wolfowitz and Doug Feith, and I can't remember the name of the third man, directed Pentagon policy and in this war against Iraq. They were the ones that pushed this false assessment of Saddam's weapons of mass destruction.
Yeah, so did Rumsfeld and so did Cheney, and neither of those guys are Jewish. Look, I'm not debating that there may have been elements of the pro-Israeli lobby in this country who pushed for war with Iraq. But you can explain the entire war with Iraq and its so-called justifications without even touching on this issue.
Well, wait a minute. You're forgetting Israel's action regarding Palestine. You're talking about torture. How about having a Gaza, for all practical purposes, is a prison camp?
Well, yeah, I understand that also. And
well,
also, hang on 1 second, Tom.
Yeah.
We have Osama bin Laden, in the aftermath of the September 11th attacks, said that the biggest factor in his organization's desire to inflict harm on the United States was our unqualified support of the Israeli subjugation of the Palestinians. Now, be that as it may, I still think it's a stretch to say that the pro-Israeli lobby here in this country drove us to war with Iraq.
Well, I don't know about driving us, but by golly, when those votes are counted, you'll find it's recognized in Washington that AIPAC at that time was the most powerful lobby in this country, and it's still some factions of that are true. We had, when Olmert came to the states here a month or so ago, which incidentally was not long before they invaded Lebanon. He was given he had a closed door meeting with Jewish organizations in New York, and then he was given a joint session of the Congress in the morning to fit it in. And there were full-page ads in newspapers across the country welcoming Mr. Olmert. I think that we forget just how powerful that faction is. And rather than talking about it, why don't we just encourage people to do two things? Number one, read GOPBias.com. Number two, read Jim Bamford's Pretext for War, pages 290 to 310. And then what also is amazing, there have been any number of books written in the last, published in the last couple of years. Bob Woodward's has one coming out next Tuesday. And do any of them discuss that relationship between the Israeli lobby and American foreign policy?
Listen, thank you very much for the call, Tom. There's a few things I need to get through before the end. I still think the reasons for the occupation invasion of Iraq have more to do with political and economic hegemony than they do with the Israeli lobby. All right. I'm going to run through these phone numbers again because I want you guys to make these calls and send these emails. Now, if you want to send an email to any representative, all you have to do is go to www.house.gov, and there's a pull-down menu that will take you to the website of any representative. And within each representative's website is a web-based form that you can fill out with your comments on whatever it is you want to comment about. So go ahead and do that. Same with the Senate, www.senate.gov. And if you want to make a phone call, which in my opinion carries a little more weight, I mean, you can have an inbox full of thousands of emails, which are easily disregarded, but it's hard when the phone is ringing off the hook to ignore that. So Earl Blumenauer, Portland office, 503-231-2300, D.C., 202-225-4811. And if you miss these numbers, I'm going to have to go through them quickly. You can get them off the representatives' websites. David Wu in Portland, 503-326-2901. In D.C., 202-225-0855. Greg Walden, Medford, 541-776-4646. D.C., 202-225-6730. Darlene Hooley, West Lynn, 503-557-1234. In D.C., 202-225-5711. Peter DeFazio, Eugene, 541-465-6732. In D.C., 202-225-6416. Gordon Smith, Portland, 503-326-3386. In D.C., 202-224-3753. And finally, Ron Wyden, Portland, 503-326-7525. In D.C., 202-224-5244. And when you make these phone calls, when you send these emails, remind particularly your, well, exclusively your Democratic representatives, that they need to focus on the administration and holding it accountable for its actions. That is what this election is about, start to finish. And the more they can focus on that, the better their chances of victory. Right now, the GOP Congress and administration are so unpopular that every Democrat running for office should be able to back their way in. But, as usual, they're doing their damnedest to snatch victory from, to snatch defeat from the jaws of victory. But if we keep this about accountability, then it becomes a little easier. If the message is continually, look at the mess you've got us into, Mr. Bush, look at the mess you've got us into, Republican Congress, what are you going to do about it? Then you can cut through every Rovian trick in the book by sticking to your guns, by holding them accountable. And what's the best way to hold a politician accountable? You vote them out. It's as simple as that. And if we want to affect any sort of lasting change, that's what it's going to take. Even though you might hate the Democrats, let me just dangle this out in front of you as I did last week. A Democratic House of Representatives means chairman John Conyers of the House Judiciary Committee. And Chairman John Conyers means a whole lot of hearings about a whole lot of nonsense. And Chairman John Conyers means that the word impeachment is all of a sudden a whole lot more than a pipe dream of the left. I think we have time for maybe one more call. Joe, good morning.
Hello.
Hey, Joe, what's happening?
First of all, I'd like to use James as an example of the people we are trying to convince when we talk about whether or not the inconsistencies and evidence that we have about 9/11 is going to blow apart Bush's delusion or whatever, and that James's delusion is so, is denial, is so bulletproof that we have to work out a whole bunch of different strategies, and we have to be talking about what's going to break down that denial. But from there, I would like to go real quickly to what we are looking at is evidence that the empire has gone past the point where it can be maintained and it's going to inevitably decline, and that Bush is a result of this imperial decline, because we come to the point where either we have policies that feed the denial and delusion of James, or else we manage the empire to where it's on a lower energy source that can be maintained under, which is what Clinton did.
Let me ask you this. Do you think this decline is reversible, or have we fallen into the same trap that every other empire has fallen into?
No, it's not reversible. It's a question of whether it goes down fast and abrupt, or slow and certain. And if those the disastrous results of the empire in the Third World, with about 30,000 children being sacrificed to mammon every day, then
well,
rapid decline may be better than a slow one.
Listen, Joe, I'm going to have to end it there. We're running out of time. I always appreciate your contributions to this program. Thanks, everybody, for calling today. Please pick up the phone today. You don't even have to make a long-distance call. Call your representatives. Ask them about the National Intelligence Estimate document. Ask them about holding this administration accountable. And most importantly, call your two senators, Gordon Smith, Ron Wyden, and tell them if they vote to legalize torture and to immunize the administration from being prosecuted under the War Crimes Act, that they are enjoying their last term in office. I'm Abe Proctor. This is KBOO. I'm back next week with your old friend Joe Uris. So keep on keeping on. Bye-bye.
Morning. You're tuned to KBOO Portland 90.7. Welcome to the Tuesday Radio Zine. Coming up first on Between the Covers, the guest is Lisa Tucker, author of Once Upon a Day, a novel about how a single day can change the course of our lives. At 9:30 on Words and Pictures, the guest is groundbreaking cartoonist Sherry Flanagan. Who started her underground career with the infamous satirical group Air Pirates and became best known for her National Lampoon comic strip, Trots and Bonnie. At 10 o'clock, local activist Patricia Barrera will honor the memory of feminist activist and author Andrea Dworkin on her birthday. We'll hear excerpts of a talk she gave in Portland over 20 years ago. At 10:30 on Stage and Studio, guest host Emily Young welcomes Olga Sanchez, director, and Joanne Farias, playwright, for Road to Xibalba at Miracle Theater. And at 11 on Democracy Now!, an Army medic and his wife are interviewed. Later today, the medic plans to turn himself into the military weeks after he went AWOL at his base in Germany. And the mayor of Salt Lake City, Rocky Anderson, discusses why he spoke out recently at a protest against President Bush and the Iraq War. Now let's go to Between the Covers. Lisa Tucker is the author of three novels. Her latest, Once Upon a Day, came out in April. Lisa, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you for having me.
Now, Once Upon a Day starts out with Stephen Spaulding driving a cab in St. Louis. This is just such a great way to start the book, and I was wondering if you could read that to our listeners, get an idea of your writing and how the story begins.
Sure, thank you. This is chapter one. Stephen Spaulding was very happy, and you can't say that about most people. He hadn't sought happiness, but he recognized it. This was his gift, to know what he had. When it was gone, of course, he knew that too. He changed from a man who could smile at strangers first thing in the morning to a man who wouldn't look anybody in the eye. He lost his family in a freak accident, and the rest he let go of as easily as opening his hand and releasing a string of balloons. Goodbye to the family practice he had just started with two friends from his residency. goodbye to the Victorian house he and Ellen had gone deeply into debt to buy when she got pregnant during his internship. Goodbye to the cradle and the tricycle and the pink and purple birthday party dress Lizzie never had a chance to wear. More than a year later, he still hadn't adjusted to the way time itself had been altered. Before, there was never enough time, and the list of things he and Ellen had not gotten around to doing was one of many things that still tortured him. The untaken trip to Paris bothered him less than the movies they'd talked about renting. Why hadn't they watched them? Ellen's entire list could be watched in a weekend. He knew this because he had done it several times. He watched the movies his wife wanted him to and thought about what she would say if she were there. This was back in the early months when he was trying to give her gifts, as though she could come back if only he worked harder to make her want this life. After the accident, there was too much time. Each day stretched before him like a flat Kansas highway, the only landmarks, the meals he forced himself to choke down, the few chores he performed, and the occasional walks he took, rarely noticing anything or anyone on his path. He finally bought the old green and white checker cab, not because he needed the income. His compensation from the city would support him forever, especially since he had no desires, nothing he wanted now, but because he could drive it as little or as much as he liked, 16 hours a day, more if his insomnia was bad. He wouldn't have sued, but the city gave him an enormous sum anyway. The newspaper headline called it a regrettable tragedy. It was a Sunday in late July. The police were chasing a teenager who had stolen a rusted-out 84 Toyota from a neighbor's driveway. The car was worth less than $500, but the patrol car that slammed into his family at the intersection had been going over 80 miles an hour. He was driving. Lizzie was in her booster seat in the back, behind Ellen. The teenage thief turned himself in when he heard what had happened. The policeman who was driving took early retirement. And Stephen, the barely 30-year-old family practice doc, became a cabbie. What difference did it make? His knowledge of how to heal bodies had done nothing for him anyway. His wife and 4-year-old daughter had still died right in front of his eyes. Now he was learning the quickest way to the airport from any street in St. Louis. How to slide around a bus and when to change lanes so his customers would feel they were making progress. What time the restaurants and bars closed, and which of his regulars would be likely to drink one too many and need a ride on a Saturday night. People often mentioned what a safe driver he was, the safest cab driver they'd ever ridden with. He nodded, but he didn't respond. He never drove without the radio playing. Talk show, pop music, news channel, it didn't matter. The radio was his excuse not to talk. The only time he would answer was when a customer asked about the amusement park tickets. They didn't ask often, even though he'd had the tickets laminated and kept them displayed above the visor, right next to his license. Stephen wasn't surprised. He knew most people aren't interested in their cab drivers. He wasn't surprised, still, he longed for the question. He longed for another opportunity to tell the whole story of that perfect July day at the amusement park, riding the water slides and the Ferris wheel and the child's roller coaster, eating hot dogs and ice cream, mint chocolate chip, Ellen's favorite, trying to win a giant stuffed panda bear, and when he couldn't make the ring toss, a setup he was sure, buying the bear for his daughter anyway. Every time he told the story, he added a few more details. As the months went by, the story often filled the entire drive. Sometimes he would still be talking while his customer was trying to hand him money and get away. He knew he was going too far, but he couldn't help himself. Back at his apartment, whenever he tried to think of that day, he drew a blank. It was only in the cab, talking to strangers, that he seemed to be able to bring it all to life, the feel of the sun on the back of his hands and the bright drips of green falling off their cones onto the hot pavement, and how awkward and adorable Lizzie looked that night, lugging the giant panda to their car. He didn't realize how he'd begun to live for these discussions until a rainy morning in April, when they suddenly came to an end. He picked up a girl at the bus station downtown, one of the weirdos, though this one wasn't pierced or tattooed or obviously strung out, but even more bizarre, naturally pale as a made-up goth, but dressed like a throwback to the 50s, long, flared black skirt, fluffy pink sweater, even the white ankle socks and saddlelocks for shoes. Her hair was in a thick braid, twisted like some kind of tight crown on top of her head, and she was sitting up so straight she looked uncomfortable, eyes unblinking, small white hands folded carefully in her lap. Stephen had already put her out of his mind when she mentioned the tickets about 10 minutes into the ride, but before he could tell her about the slides or the food or even the perfect weather that day, she noticed what no one else had, that the tickets weren't stubs. "What happened?" she said. "Why didn't you ever use those?" He flushed with confusion that quickly turned to anger. It had taken him nearly a year to perfect the story of the amusement park. For Christ's sakes, couldn't he have even this? He wasn't asking for all the days and hours and minutes he would have had with Ellen and Lizzie. He was just asking for one more day. Stephen had been taking his family to the park when their car was broadsided. Lizzie had wanted to go all summer, and that day they had the tickets. They were really finally going. All he had done in his story was change "were going" to "had gone." A mere verb shift, and yet it changed everything. And now the strange girl in his cab was forcing him to change it back. Her voice was entirely innocent. She had no idea what she'd taken from him. But then again, he had no idea what she was about to give.
That passage, it was so well crafted because it kind of sneaks up on you and you realize how this loss is just still, he's carrying it around.
Right, and it's resonating in everything he thinks and says.
Right, his entire life has become a shrine to his lost family. The idea that this accident is just one little incident that changes his life forever is really central to the book, that this is what happens to people in general. Was there an incident in your life that changed everything, that kind of gave you an idea for this?
Well, my life, I mean, it's interesting. My life has taken a lot of different directions, and it has changed, but it's not so much in a day. It's over time. You know, I'm meeting my husband, deciding to be a writer, having our son. But I have had some tragedies, too. I had a really bad car accident. I was broadsided by a Cadillac. And I think whenever, especially car accidents, I mean, what I remember about this car accident was, like, right afterwards, the radio was still playing, you know, and the same song was playing, and, you know, the car was totaled, and, you know, it was so odd to have that a car accident is definitely that experience that everything has changed right then, and it's a sort of horrifying thing. But in the book, I also wanted to talk about, like, Stephen has had this tragedy, but I wanted to talk about the girl that gets in his cab, that's a random thing too. And he's very interested in the randomness. Like, does it mean life is meaningless if any kind of random thing can take everybody you love away from you? Well, but there's also the random chance of meeting someone that's going to be very important to you. And if his cab had driven up 5 minutes later, he wouldn't have met her. So the circumstances, you know, the universe has to align in a way for
right.
these things to happen.
He gets everything taken away, but then he, in a way, he doesn't get everything given back, but he gets a lot given back.
He gets a chance again, another chance at another life.
The central character is Dorothea, who's the girl who gets into the cab.
The weird girl, right?
Right. She's been raised in complete isolation.
Right.
Her father just wanted to protect her and her brother from the real world. And it doesn't really quite work because eventually they have to deal with the real world. And they're completely unequipped to do it. Do you think that children are, especially in this culture, damaged by overprotective parents?
That's a really good question. Yeah, because for 19 years, he's kept them away from all of culture, TV, radio. And in a way, what they do gain from that is this very sophisticated education, even though it doesn't go into modern times. You know, they've read Shakespeare, they've read Spencer, they know mathematics. A lot of parents, I think, have that impulse to homeschool. Some of it is for reasons that I maybe don't approve of, you know, like to keep their kids from interacting with other children. But the impulse to give your kid the best education you can, that I think comes out in the book too, and Dorothea and Jimmy are very educated. But I think that, I guess I don't think overprotective parents, I mean, Charles is so extreme. I'm trying to think if I've known anybody. I mean, I'm a little bit of an overprotective mom myself, but I've worked against that because I want Miles, that's my son, to be able to make his own decisions and get out there. And I also really love popular culture, actually. And I think the way to do that is not keep your kids from watching things, but talk to them about it and stuff like that. But I do know people, I guess, who I think they're raising their child as though, in a way, yeah, they're not going to have to interact with real people. You know,
right.
they're like, they drive them from one point A to point B for their play dates. Like, you know, and then there's that whole thing, like, in our culture right now about stranger danger. And it's just
right.
So ridiculous. I mean, you know, I was thinking the other day, like, kids are raised not to talk to strangers. And, like, a kid could be lost, and he won't ask for help.
Right.
You know, it's really weird, because strangers are not dangerous normally. You know, honestly, that's like such a small percent of the population, and yet Americans are taught sort of be afraid of people they don't know,
right.
Which keeps us from reaching out and forming the kind of communities that would really help children.
I remember when my kids were very little, I went to hear somebody talk about child raising, and he called the overprotective parents the helicopter parents because they were over hovering nearby.
Right. Right.
And I just
That's
loved that
one.
Image because, you know, it's like, well, no, you got to teach the kids so that they can function in the world.
Right.
And to have a sense of competence, which I think ultimately was the problem with Jimmy, is that he didn't have basic competencies to go out into the world.
Right. I mean, they're very smart, but they don't have any kind of real-world experience. And, you know, it doesn't work unless you can keep them away from everybody forever.
Right.
And you don't even want to do that. I mean, that's one of the points of the book, too. I mean, there's all this risk in loving someone. And people are the people we love are so fragile. I mean, life is so fragile, but not taking the risk like Charles tries to do, where he's trying to protect them from everything. It's obviously a mistake.
Right. Now, Lucy is Dorothea's mother, and she has this kind of rags-to-riches story, which I understand kind of parallels your own life. And, you know, that's one of those questions about competency in only in overcoming a lot of obstacles that you actually really do develop your whole potential or explore parts of yourself that unless you're challenged, you're really not going to go there. How do you think your own experiences with having a very challenging background influence the way you write?
That's a good question, too. I don't think I had the courage to write until, I mean, I didn't start writing until 1995, which, you know, it's a long time ago now, 11 years, but it's not a long time in a writer's life. Like, most writers you meet have been writing, you know, I was 12 years old, I was writing, you know, and I was already in graduate school in English, and I'd been in graduate school for a while when I decided to even try. I mean, I think there's a permission that you get from maybe growing up in certain circumstances where your parents no writers, or, you know, your prep school, maybe people think they can be writers, that in my background, no one was a writer, and, you know, it wasn't something you could do, like, those were other kinds of people, so I think that there's a challenge there, and, you know, when I go out and talk to high school kids that are in, you know, inner city schools, I want them to believe that their voices are valuable, you know, and that they could be a writer, even if they don't know any writers, because I think that's one thing that I feel from my background. I mean, they're, you know, I grew up poor, and yet, you know, now I'm able to do this. But the other thing I think is that it does give you, like, sort of a sense of complexity of life. I mean, so I think I have a well of different kinds of people to draw on. I can write about a character like Lucy or Patty in my other books, or even Charles, actually, the father. I mean, these people that grow up, I'm very interested in what happens when people, like, American dream is that, you know, you're poor and then you switch classes, and, you know, I heard recently that that's actually not very true anymore, that supposedly we're a society where poor, if you are born poor, you're more likely to stay poor than most European countries. I hope that's not true, but
I read that too.
I was like stunned, actually, but talking about people who have done it, I mean, there's a weird isolation, like if you did grow up poor and now you're not, and you've sort of made it, like, by whatever standard that is, and usually it's educational, like in my case, like if you get to a point where you go to graduate school and you're in an Ivy League school, you have you're the scholarship kid, there's all this, you know, strange class dissonance, you know, like where do you really belong?
And I think I'm interested in that. Do you really know which fork you're supposed to be picking up?
Well, right. And just like assumptions like that people make about what, how they can talk about, you know, and especially Southerners, you know, I mean, I think our culture is really split about what poor people are like, if that makes sense. You know what I mean? Like that there's a lot of denigration of people who are homeless, and the same people who work in the soup kitchen, in a way, kind of believe that it's the fault of the people who are homeless.
Right.
So there's our society, I think just like with race, there's a lot of class anxiety. So when you straddle classes, you feel that on every side. You know, you go back to where you were at home, and it's like, are you, you know, do you look down on them now? You know what I mean? Like, there's a lot of chips there that you have to kind of work through.
When
but then in your new culture, you always feel like, you know, the scholarship girl. Like
right.
That's,
and it's like, how much of your background do you actually reveal, and how much of a front do you put on to fit in?
Exactly. Yeah, you got it. Do you have it from personal experience?
Yeah.
Okay, cool.
So a lot of this story is about finding hope. Stephen eventually finds a reason to keep going, and Lucy, who has just been through horrible experiences, but she manages to keep going. It sounds like you've had quite a few setbacks in your own life, and what gives you the most hope? What keeps you going?
Well, yeah, and you're right, that's the point of the book, because when I wrote the first chapter after a real thing happened, I was in New York on tour. I don't know if you read this in any of the interviews that I've done, but I was in New York on tour, and I got out of a TV show, and I got in a cab, and I won't give you the whole story, but the cab driver at the end of a conversation that we had, he said, you know, he loved America, he was an immigrant, but he said, since 9/11, I've lost my hope. And, you know, this really affected me, because here's this guy that felt like he'd found his dream, you know, by being here. So I kept...
The biggest export America's got is hope.
Right.
We lose that, boy, are we bankrupt.
Right, exactly. Almost to the point of forgetting the past. I mean, sometimes to get our hope, we just, you know, put our blinders on, but we need, you know, we'll get it somehow. So I wanted to find, like, this legitimate hope for all the characters. That was sort of the task I set myself. And as a, you know, in my real life, I do think it's a struggle. I mean, I think my son, of course, is a big part of, you know, I think if you have a child, then you have to have hope. I mean,
you've got a stake in the future then.
Right, right. And you have to raise them with something like optimism. No matter what's going on, you know, like different things can be going on politically, whatever. You know, you try to tell your child that things can change. I mean, I think really the foundation of hope is change and the belief in change. Like that way, no matter what's going on, you believe that things can change and that you may be able to have some effect on how they change. I mean, somebody very dear to me was dying of cancer, and we still believe that the changes, that every day we, you know, made changes to the outlook that we had on the world. I mean, we grew really close while she was sick, and I think that I found through that experience, you know, that we kept our hope alive until, you know, she actually died. And then I had a lot of trouble. You know, I went into a really pretty big depression.
Oh,
you know?
Because it wasn't accepting that she was going to die.
No, it was accepting it, but we didn't really accept. I feel like you really can't accept that on some level about someone you really love. You can talk about it and act like you accept it, but when they're gone, you know, they're not there to talk about it anymore.
Right.
That type of thing, you know,
right.
So that, but I did, I do, her life was a real model for me because she did keep hope through all of this. And she changed. She became a deeper person, weirdly, through this experience. And I was like, how are you doing this? Like, you know, it was really interesting to get close to somebody in a situation like that and watch their desire to live their life in a big way with hope right until the last day, you know? She's a really strong woman.
The characters you have in this book, the kids, Jimmy and Dorothea, who've been raised in this isolation, are really pretty extreme. And one of the things about Dorothea that makes her so charming is she's got this combination of innocence and wisdom, where she's read Jane Eyre over and over and over again, but she's never tasted a pickle or watched TV.
And the pickle thing is, it's her dad, like, ordered, just so the listener knows, her dad would order their food from Colorado Springs. So he just happened to not like pickles. So they live on this, you know, sanctuary thing where only the things that their dad brings in. So when she gets out, she tastes her first pickle. So it's just a funny thing. She knows what it is. She says something like, yes, I know what they are. My father didn't like them, you know.
Right. And so it's, I mean, part of her charm of her character is this observer, but she's also kind of really clueless about a lot of things because her education stopped, history stopped for her in the 1950s.
Right.
How did you come up with the details for how she would view the world?
It just, for me, everything comes from voice. Like, once I heard her speaking, and that happens fairly quickly, the beginning of chapter two, she starts telling us about the way she lived. Her voice guided me, you know, to what she believed and what she thought. Like, when Stephen says, she's trying to explain something to Stephen, and she goes, do you want to know why? And he says, sure, I'll bite. And she goes, bite what? And they have this whole literal, she's very literal because there's a lot of idioms that she doesn't know. But her voice was right there for me. And it just sort of gave me, as long as I stayed in with her voice, I follow the voices of the characters around. I know that sounds weirdly mystical, but that's the way it works. And then I get the real, if I tried to take over, like let's say Dorothea wasn't telling me something, and I forced her to tell me this because I needed it for the plot, then it would get artificial. But as long as I wait and let her tell me the story, if you know what I mean, then it all fits.
Yes, I had a good friend who was schizophrenic, and I realized that the process of writing was a lot like that.
I think so.
We were both listening to the voices in our heads.
Right, exactly. I know, isn't that weird? I know. Well, I mean, I think probably subconsciously, though, I mean, my field in graduate school was 19th century literature, so I love these books. I mean, Jane Eyre, Moby Dick, all these books from the 19th century and so I knew that I wanted Dorothea to be someone who had primarily experienced the world through novels. Because even though her dad and brother and grandma are there, she has hours and hours that she's alone. So she's read, she's like a reader without a life, you know, what a reader would be. And so she does talk in a way that's sort of 19th century. That was really fun for me, actually, because I, you know, without having to write historical fiction, I sort of have this character that's sort of walked out of a 19th century novel.
Yeah, yeah, she's great. She's really charming. So, how about a next project?
Well, I'm working on something, and I'm, because of my process, the way it works with the following the voices, I try to sort of not say anything while they're still telling me the story. Like, I don't want to, like, jinx it or whatever, you know.
So
I don't
it's
know.
In the really early stages at
no,
this
No, it's
time.
Actually probably about halfway.
Wow.
Yeah, it is, but I try not to talk about work while I'm working on it, basically. Once I'm done, then I can say what it's about.
You kind of shield them until they're stronger.
I always tell them, you know, okay, don't worry, we're fine now, you know, and then when they tell me the whole story, then I have to turn them in because I have a contract with Simon & Schuster. But before that, I even Simon & Schuster, I try not to tell them anything. They accept that, too. They're good about that.
Well, that's encouraging.
I know.
Okay. I'm Marianne Barasonic. I've been talking with Lisa Tucker. Her new novel is Once Upon a Day. And Lisa, thank you so much for coming in and talking with us.
Thank you. I had a great time.
My name is Becky Chow. I'm running for a spot on the KABU Board of Directors. My historical connection to KABU has been as a listener and member. I have experience with nonprofit organizations both as a staff member and as a board volunteer, primarily in the field of immigrants' rights. As someone without a lot of KBOO experience, I don't have a specific agenda or platform. I think the station should be accessible to a broad range of listeners and volunteers throughout Portland and beyond. I subscribe to KBOO's programming values of peace, justice, democracy, human rights, multiculturalism, environmentalism, freedom of expression, and social change, and I love hearing all kinds of great music. I'm excited about the election and look forward to the opportunity to get more involved. This is Becky Chow. Thank you for listening.
My name is Mark Anderson, and I'm running for the KBOO board. As a recently retired civil engineer, I can offer team-building skills gleaned from my experience of working on local and national-level policymaking groups. Valuing diversity is a personal goal that I work on every day. I believe in the station's mission statement, especially that of giving a voice to those that are underrepresented in the mainstream media. Presently, I serve as a substitute receptionist at the KBOO's front desk, and I volunteer during pledge drives. I'm excited about the potential to work as part of a team that can help KBOO be the great community station that it currently is, and the opportunity to assist in furthering its success and growth. Once again, my name is Mark Anderson, and I would be proud to serve KBOO Community Radio on its board of directors.
You're listening to KBOO Community Radio, 90.7. It's 9:29. Still to come on the radio zine at 10 o'clock, local activist Patricia Barrera will honor the memory of feminist activist and author Andrea Dworkin on her birthday. We'll hear excerpts of a talk she gave in Portland over 20 years ago. And at 10:30, on stage and studio, guest host Emily Young welcomes Olga Sanchez, director, and Joanne Farias, playwright, for Road to Xibalba at Miracle Theater. Up next on Words and Pictures, the guest is groundbreaking cartoonist Sherry Flanagan, who started her underground career with the infamous satirical group Air Pirates and became best known for her National Lampoon comic strip Trots and Bonnie.
Welcome to Words and Pictures, once again reporting from the road. I'm Bill Dodge.
And I'm S.W. Conser, and we're joined today by a very special guest, Sherry Flanagan. She's been a trailblazer in the history of underground comics and made a very entertaining appearance in the documentary Comic Book Confidential. Welcome, Sherry.
Hello.
And we're in Seattle today, which is your hometown. There seems to be a great many artists from Seattle whose work delves into dark themes. I'm thinking folks like Linda Barry and Jim Woodring, and something about the climate here, the long, damp winters with the fish belly skies.
It's very dark, very early. That's what people don't realize. They move up here from California and discover that there's this darkness that descends around 4 o'clock. And that's when everybody kind of holds up and draws a lot, mm-hmm. and writes a lot and thinks depressing thoughts.
Everything starts to look like a David Lynch movie.
Yes, well, and then they just go out and shoot it.
You created a really influential comic for the National Lampoon called Trots and Bonnie. And tell us a little bit about the characters in Trots and Bonnie.
Well, thank you very much for getting the name right, because most people end up calling it Bonnie and Trots for some reason. And I don't know why that is, and it's kind of a silly name anyway. But Bonnie was actually the name of my dog when I was a kid. So I memorialized the dog in this comic strip. But tell you something about the characters? Well, they're very much Bonnie is very much me. And I hate to say that because she does take off her clothes a few times, but what she does that's really important is she doesn't react to things. She's really slow in reacting, so she's kind of a different character, because most of the time your lead character in I'll call it dramatic piece, does all the action, and she's just a kind of a sounding board for the world going on around her, which I really related to when I was writing it. And she just doesn't because she doesn't respond, things can play out in front of her, and then the dog can have the tagline. And then she has this little friend who was actually modeled on friends that I have who carried guns in their purses and are instantly having a... They did, yeah, this woman. Respond immediately with an opinion on any given subject. And that's her little friend, Pepsi. And that was, you know, Pepsi was the drink for those who think young. You know, it was sort of a, Hollywood, yeah.
We thought it might be a Pippi Longstocking reference.
Well, no, but actually I stole the art style from a cartoonist named H.T. Webster, who was doing a comic strip called Casper Milktoast back in 1915, 1916, went to the Chicago Art Institute, and his mother was a friend of my father's family. So we had this sort of personal connection that made me feel a little bit better about stealing his art style, and also about, you know, really liking what he was doing with his work, because it was very realistic. But not realistic like Marvel Comics. It was realistic like you looked at it and it looked like a real person, not a, you know, what they call Bigfoot cartoons. You know, the big feet and the kind of distorted faces. These were like totally not distorted cartoon characters. So I adopted them. That was part of our, the Air Pirates, this group I was involved in, which I guess you know about.
Absolutely.
There's a big legal case.
Mm-hmm. We had, like, you know, you'd call it, like, a salon, an art salon, like they have in France, in San Francisco, where we were all learning to do cartoons at the same time and kind of all learning and all teaching each other. And we'd have people who, you know, would come in and want to work with us, and we would actually weed them out.
Sort of like the Zap artists that were working on Zap. Zap Comics, the very influential underground 60s comics.
Absolutely, yes.
Even though you don't talk about it in Comic Book Confidential, Dan O'Neill is talking about it right before you in the movie. So give us the background on the salon.
Oh, well, the whole background? Because it's
pretty... Well, just the high points.
Pretty involved. Well, you know, Dan O'Neill really was the ringleader on this, I think. He had this comic strip with the San Francisco Chronicle called Odd Bodkins.
Yeah, classic.
And he was fired 3 times, and I guess the last time stuck, and he decided that he was going to make some waves in the world. I mean, the war was going on, and it was an anti-military industrial complex kind of statement to go after Walt Disney, because Walt Disney, according to Richard Schickel's book, the Disney version, held the patents on the, I don't know, warheads and things like that. And you can read it, yeah. Well, that was sort of a Bible for these guys back then, and I was sort of a hanger-on. And learning how to play with the big boys in the cartooning market is what I was doing. And so Dan had this idea to hire winos and dress them up in police uniforms and have them, like, laying around San Francisco all day. And that would be their job, would be to lay around San Francisco in police uniforms and distribute our comic books. That was going to be our distribution system. And they'd be policemen one day, and then another day they'd be, like, you know, firemen or doctors or whatever.
Brilliant.
Yeah, it was a great idea. He was full of wonderful ideas, and we all, you know, loved him because he was so much fun and such a great ringleader. And he found these guys that had sex fantasies about Minnie Mouse for, you know, since they were 5 years old and just were sucked into this plan. And were incredibly talented artists because they'd been drawing Minnie Mouse nude for a long time. And
it seems so odd. Which is exactly what happens in Air Pirates.
Yeah.
Minnie and Mickey are doing it in jail.
Yeah.
And you find out what they look like with no clothes on.
Yeah. And then you find out that they were actually married.
Right.
You know. And
those weren't nephews.
And they were the illegitimate children that before the marriage, I guess. And, yeah, so it was, these guys had a lot of fun drawing those books, and they let me draw sometimes.
A lot of fun until the wrath of God came down.
Well.
Or the wrath of Disney's lawyers.
Yeah, yeah.
the people that act like God, anyway. Did it take about 12, 13 years to finally settle the lawsuit? It was a long time, wasn't it?
Well, there was within a couple of years, there was what they call a summary judgment, mm-hmm. which told these guys not to publish any more comic books.
Yeah.
So everyone was scared away by that, except O'Neill, who was out on the East Coast organizing artists.
The Mouse Liberation Front.
Yes, yeah. And they were out there selling mouse balls, which are little malted milk balls. It was like they'd be selling them to support their cause.
We were laughing about the fact that Phil Frank, who was drawing Travels with Farley at the time, put little Mouse Liberation Front logos, or whatever you want to call them, in his strips as kind of a support. He didn't actually mention what was going on with the Air Pirates exactly, but...
No, just a great little inside joke.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, you know what he was doing when he was 5.
Maybe, Sherry, you would, if you would be so kind to list who else was in the Air Pirates. Ted Richards, that's a name that comes to mind right away, because
yes.
I met him about the time the lawsuit was wrapping up.
Yes.
But who else?
You can find Ted Richards at tedrichards.net.
Thanks. Oh, Gary Halvern is the other one, right?
Yeah, he's hard to find on the internet. But mm-hmm. Ted's selling copies of, like, the 40-year-old hippie and things.
Cool.
Yeah, you can get CDs of his books. And Gary is in Massachusetts and mm-hmm. doing a lot of illustration work. You would have seen him. He's been on the cover of Forbes and Time and all these mm-hmm. important magazines. And... O'Neill is in Nevada City, California. He's doing his comic strip Odd Bodkins. And
oh, he did it. I didn't realize he had revived it. That's
you
great.
Know, he sends that. He's doing that strip, and he's sending it out weekly over, you know, you can subscribe to it by cool. sending him an email. It's probably danoneill.com. And he'd send that comic strip out, and it's great. Still, it's like he's got Osama bin Laden hidden in a gold mine in Nevada City. And that's why they haven't been able to find him over in Iraq or Afghanistan. Yeah.
It's too bad that there don't seem to be as many outlets for underground comics as there used to be.
Oh, hello.
Yeah, back
in... Well, the head shop's closed.
Right. And also National Lampoon went down the tubes back in the 70s. They had an entire comic section, 80s into the 80s and 90s even. You know, Tross and Bonnie was definitely one of the standouts. And what was great to me was here was this world of kids. It was almost like an edgier version of Peanuts, almost, because here is a world that's got all of this crazy political and sexual energy, a lot of confusion. And the kids are just reacting to it in the way that kids are, but it just sometimes goes really over the top.
You are like my ideal reader. It's amazing that you're not in prison.
We're working on it.
We paid pretty close attention to National Lampoon when it would hit the stands, and we were talking about how at one point you could go down to places like Safeway and buy it along with the Ladies' Home Journal until they kind of caught on to what was in there. And things got a little bit more conservative, and then Lampoon unfortunately died. We were kidding that it was taken over by frat boys, and
not much of an exaggeration.
Well,
PJ O'Rourke.
Well, it was started by frat boys.
Harvard Lampoon was the original influence.
Oh yeah, they leased the name mm-hmm. from the Harvard Lampoon. They continued to pay for it.
Let's see, I think the earliest issue I saw Trotz and Bonnie in my archives, I was looking at October 1972.
Oh, that was maybe the first one.
Was it?
The little girl and the dog, and the dog's performing, and she says, why won't you sing or something? She wants the dog to talk. It's the fabulous talking dog, and he's refusing to talk.
You know, I don't recall, to be honest. I was just wondering when you came on board at the magazine.
You didn't really read it.
Yeah, I did. Anyway.
Okay.
The point is, I was trying to get to this point about how you originally started at Lampoon, because I know the magazine started, what, about 1969? And...
You want to know how I transitioned from San Francisco Underground to the magazine?
To the big glossies.
To the big time. Because, you know, Robert Crumb and Artie Spiegelman would, like, have these sessions with the underground comic cartoonists in San Francisco, and they'd sit cross-legged on the floor and talk to them about, you know, in a little circle, in a little spiritual circle, and they'd talk to them about how important it was for them not to sell out to the overground, and they used to trash the sky Von Bode.
The guy who came up with Church Wizard.
Famous, wonderful artist who influenced graffiti artists.
All over the world. If you go to Europe, and the movie Wizards was based on his work.
Yeah. There's probably a lot of youngster graffiti artists that don't even know that they're borrowing from this now legendary cartoonist that was on the same pages with you, along with Jeff Jones. And why were they trashing him? Because he was too slick, or because we
too
loved
slick,
him?
Don't be overground. You know, that's, you know, I think with artists, they want to be a really select group. There's some people who really want to be a select group and feel like they're the avant-garde, and they get kind of a thrill out of being part of a small group. And that was never my orientation, because I started out in underground newspapers, and I was thrilled to work in underground newspapers because I could take the art and line the cat box with them. I just thought that was great. You know, here's a bunch of throwaway art, you know.
Fish wrap.
Yeah. Now Crumb and Spiegelman are on the cover of The New Yorker. Oh, irony.
Well, it was irony back then, too, because Artie was working for Topps Bubblegum and made all his money doing, you
wacky
know,
packages.
Funny. Yeah. So he was actually working for the overground and telling people not to work for the overground. I've never confronted him on this, but I mention it every now and then when I get a chance.
You still got to pay your bills, though. I know that Crumb was pretty famous for turning people down a lot. But I don't know. The way those of us that are running around trying to draw comics now or do animation, a job's a job. And you don't always have to put your name on it.
And he had an ex-wife to support, too.
Exactly.
And then when you got one of those, then you really have to make some bucks. So, anyway, that was the environment at the time there.
So they invited everybody except Vaughn.
No. Well, that was in San Francisco. The Lampoon used to send out recruiters.
Mm-hmm.
And this wonderful man, Michel Chiquette, came to San Francisco and was working on a project called The Someday Funnies.
Yeah.
And do you know about that?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
But our listeners might not. So
it was never finished. But it was, the cover was, you must have read my interview in Comics Journal or something. The cover was going to be a family watching John Kennedy being shot, and the mother saying to the father, I think, someday we'll all look back on this and laugh.
Mm-hmm.
And he had all these really famous people, like John Lennon, and doing comic strips for this book, and it was a great idea. And he came out, and he got us to do some, the Air Pirates. He got the Air Pirates to do some comics for him. And we all did, and sent them in, and never saw them again. I don't know what happened to him. And, but because he did that, Bobby and I were married, we got married, and we went back to live in Queens with his parents for a while, and we just went to the Lampoon office and hung out.
Oh, I see. Okay.
So this is the legendary Bobby London, who did a strip called Dirty Duck for National Lampoon, and then later he was the guy who was tapped to do the daily Popeye strip in the late 80s for newspaper comics, and he had grown up doing E.C. Segar's style, the guy who originated Popeye, and also, I think, George Harriman's style, who did Crazy Cat.
Merton of the Movement, too. We loved that. And I think you guys both worked on a thing that was pretty short-lived in Seattle called the Seattle Simpleton.
Yes, we did do that. It was a tabloid newspaper style. Yeah, that was a lot of fun. Yeah. They were in somebody's basement, and they all got burned. So if you can find a copy, it's a collector's item.
Unfortunately, I loaned all my copies out, and they never came back. So it occurred to me when I was up here in Seattle at that time buying those, I guess at Pike Place, or they were just around. They were pretty easily found, at least by me, that I was seeing stuff that wasn't appearing anywhere else.
It wasn't. Holly Tuttle, Norman Hathaway.
You're saying that the copies got destroyed. Did the artwork get destroyed too, original artwork? Because I've always wanted to track that down again.
Some of the original artwork?
Yeah, it was enjoyable.
I don't know. I might have some in my basement, but I'd have to look. I never thought about the original artwork. Yeah.
I was just curious because I know it didn't live very long, but it was great to see it.
Yeah.
So, so Seattle was quite a scene for cartoonists back in the 70s and early 80s.
Then. We thought so. Yeah. And for no particular reason. It was just there were a lot of important people artistically here. Gary Halgren worked with Doug Fast, who started Splendid Sign Company and revolutionized sign painting for the Pacific Northwest, if not the whole country.
One thing about some of the underground cartoons, the ones like Trots and Bonnie that ran in the Lampoon, was that, you know, they shocked a lot of people and offended people, but there was always this underground, this undercurrent, this literary and political background that was very sophisticated, such as, I'm remembering one in particular where Bonnie goes down the street to a rich neighbor girl's house, and they're playing with the shrunken heads of Latin American rebels, and, you know, and this is just outrageous, but it's really, really wonderful stuff, and nowadays you'll see cartoonist animators who are trying to be over the top and trying to be offensive, and there's nothing there. It's just pure shock value. It's just pure gross out humor. Do you, you know, what happened to all the, you know, to all the people who were trying to shock the bourgeois?
Well, you're totally getting it. That's really interesting. Although the shock value thing was always there. I mean, Rory Hayes, who passed away, was a cartoonist in the underground who did a lot of, you know, stabbing. And S. Clay Wilson, there's a lot of drunken stabbing and boob cutting and stuff like that. And I think maybe a lot of my work was in response to that at some level, just to have more meaning. But I was coming out of a very, you know, political arena here in Seattle. I was a revolutionary here in Seattle and stopped traffic on the freeway, not far from where we are right now. And I just didn't, I don't really, I think that art should have some meaning to it and have some value to it. And if you're going to print it on paper and kill trees to print it, then salon some value to the person who's consuming it as well. So I have a way that I work through my stories and structure my stories, the whole process I use to create a comic. It sounds kind of boring, but I have a paradigm that I work through. And so I think, actually, that's the basic difference, I think, is I think about it. A lot of people like to work through their gut, and I like to work through my brain. And therefore, if you give me a subject like work, I end up with a story like Trapped in the Toilet Factory, which I did for Lampoon because it was how I felt about working for Lampoon, was that I was in this sort of kind of toilety environment. But
a lot of poo-poo humor from the boys.
Yeah. But, you know, I was sort of making the best of it, and that's what Trapped in the Toilet Factory is about, this manager who really believes in these toilets. And, you know, I could parse any one of my comic strips for you and tell you what the meaning is.
Well, that's that actually hits on a point that I was always wondering about looking at your cartoons, is that did you ever take any flack from women readers over the fact that you were in this very male-centric environment, and in fact you were drawing cartoons that had a lot of sexual content, some of it involving underage girls experimenting, and it seems like some women would take offense at that and think that you were catering to a male audience, that you were that you were encouraging really bad behavior.
I love it that you're asking me this question, because it's totally like something that you're making up in your own male brain that it might happen, because it never happened.
Really?
No, I never got any flack at all. In fact, most of the stuff that I've written, I've got a lot of support from women.
Okay.
And the only, I did get in trouble for doing, there are two strips that I can think of offhand where I got myself in trouble, because sometimes I would process a thought, an idea, a kind of a what-if idea, and I'd process it right there on paper and create a comic strip, and it would get printed or not. And in one case, it didn't get printed. But the politics of it were really not too great. And one of those was a strip that I did for Ann Beats that she hated and several women hated.
She's a TV writer, if I recall.
Yeah, and she also was one of the first, or I would say the first woman editor of National Lampoon. And she was there because she was really quick, really fast, and could make those deadlines and really funny. And she was editing a book called Titters and wanted to ask me to do something for it. And I did a strip called Rape Patrol. And the idea behind Rape Patrol was really, you know, when you start messing with women's liberation, you can get in a lot of trouble. And it was on the subject of rape. And it was kind of, my idea was, how is rape any different from really bad sex? Okay, so you probably won't even want to put that on the radio. So, yeah, so I sort of explored that, and it was a really unsuccessful story. And the other thing that I did was a comic strip that did get printed in Lampoon, and it was called, like, Trots and Bonnie and Whiteface, and it was about, I was fascinated by the fact that Idi Amin was killing his own people, and that black people in Africa were, you know, had this tribal violence. And I just didn't get how oppressed people would kill other oppressed people, whether they were in Africa or, you know, in the slums here. And I kind of worked that out in this comic story where Bonnie is the only one, the only white kid who comes to school one day, and there's this tribal war going on by his high school Idi Amin character, president, class president, running around in a Boy Scout uniform, like killing all the other black kids and putting their heads in the lockers. And so I did this in Lampoon. Bless their hearts. They printed it, and I still have this tape that I got from a Nazi in Michigan. Commending me for this great comic strip, you know, killing these people. So that really taught, that was feedback. It was intense. I mean, it really had an effect on me. It was feedback that really taught me a lesson about humor, and I think being understood in your humor is one of the big challenges for somebody who writes humor. Having people get the joke.
Yeah, if you couch step in too much irony, it gets easily lost.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't even think you have to couch it. I think it's just easy for people to misunderstand what you're saying, and you just have to know that.
I think you mentioned before that the style you were using kind of threw people off because it had it gave people the impression that you were innocent or naive, but you were talking about really serious subjects like you just mentioned. It wasn't drawn like, let's say, S. Clay Wilson or whatever. It was... At first glance, it
very
looks
much
like
drawn like some of the early newspaper comics of the 20th century.
Right.
You bet. Yeah. Well, and it worked.
Yeah, you bet. It did.
It drew people in unawares, and then you hit them with a 2x4.
Yeah. But, you know, I think what's a lot of people ask me, you know, why aren't you drawing Trots and Bonnie now? And why don't you make a movie? And why don't you do something on TV? And the thing is that it's all over the place now. When I started out doing that comic strip, we didn't have that kind of, we didn't have that kind of freedom of speech. And I keep reminding people, even at Lampoon, I was reminding people that people died to say the F word in People's Park in Berkeley. And when I was in a really formative age, that happened. That was a reality for us. So that was important then. It's not so important now. I think there's something else to say now.
Can you tell us where folks can see your work on the web?
CherryFunnican.com. www.sherryfunnican.com.
And so it threw me off a little bit. Your first name is spelled how?
S-H-A-R-Y. And my last name is spelled F as in Frank, L-E-N-N-I-K-E-N.
You know, one of the things that I thought of recently was, I don't think this was an intentional, but I noticed a similarity between Calvin and Hobbes, which came later than Trots and Bonnie. There's this animal character who's kind of detached, a bit of a Greek chorus, and then there's this kid character who's much more, you know, taking in everything around, you know, taking in all this information and processing it. And I wonder if that was ever an influence, or if it's just something that's floating out there in the ether all the time, kind of a mythical thing, the child and the animal.
I would say ether.
Mm-hmm.
Because there's Skippy is another comic strip, I think, that with a little kid and a dog, and I'm sure there, well, Little Orphan Annie is mm-hmm. another one that I wasn't really copying, but it's a kid and a dog.
In the old days of Blondie, too, the dogs would react to everything that was going on, usually.
Yeah.
Not verbally, but they would be in every panel and reacting in some way. Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures on KABU with myself, Bill Dodge, and co-host S.W. Concer. Our guest has been legendary underground cartoonist Sherry Flanagan. Not so underground right now, though.
Thank you. The underground doesn't exist anymore.
Exactly. Well, how about alternative?
It's the alternative ground. Yeah,
yeah. That's the word they use.
Yeah, I'm not in there.
Thanks very much for joining us, though.
To KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. At 10:30, still to come on the radio zine, is Stage and Studio. Guest host Emily Young welcomes Olga Sanchez, director, and Joanne Farias, playwright, for Road to Xibalba at Miracle Theater. And also, Oregon Children's Theater's To Give a Mouse a Cookie will be featured. And now, local activist Patricia Barrera will honor the memory of feminist activist and author Andrea Dworkin on her birthday.
Good morning, this is Kathleen Stevenson for the Radio Zine, and as Janet mentioned, along with me here today is Patricia Barrera, who is a longtime anti-pornography and anti-violence against women and anti-prostitution activist in the area. She founded the Baldwin Foundation in 1999 and has taught a class on the feminist author and activist Andrea Dworkin at the Red Rose School when that was in existence a number of years ago. Patricia, welcome. Thanks for coming
Thank you. I'm really excited to be here.
And also with Patricia today is Lila Lee, who is a feminist legal scholar and has worked with the Baldwin Foundation in the legal role. She is also has a Master's of Law from the University of Michigan Law School. She's a writer, teacher, advocate for women's history, and also she studied with Catherine MacKinnon. Thank you very much, Lila Lee, for being here.
I'm happy to be here.
And both these women are here because this program is meant to be a tribute to the work of Andrea Dworkin, and Patricia and Lila are going to start out by telling us why why we're honoring the memory of Andrea Dworkin and just who she was, for the fact that some people don't remember who she was.
Well, today is what would have been her 60th birthday, and she leaves a legacy of amazing critical feminist thinking, an amazing legacy of practical, actual, legal powers that she had hoped to give to women to protect ourselves and defend our integrity in the world. And she was critical to me in helping raise my consciousness about sexual violence generally, but prostitution specifically. And I'm really excited to be here to honor her and to discuss what she's contributed to feminist movement, both here in the United States as well as internationally. She's a critically acclaimed author and activist. People from all over the world mourned her death last year, and I just want to celebrate what she has left behind, an amazing legacy.
And Lila, why are you here?
Well, what a lot of people don't really realize about Andrea is that although she was not a lawyer, she was such a brilliant, groundbreaking, original, far-ranging thinker that she wound up having a really pretty big effect on American law. And I would like people to know more about that.
Okay. And is there anything that either of you want to say about how you came to be interested in her work?
Well, I started learning about feminism through school. In college, I started attending consciousness-raising groups and reading critical thinkers. And when I read her, it was the feminist click. Women described that moment of realization where everything just falls into place, comes together. And I had that epiphany when I read Andrea, and I was so so amazed by how eloquently she spoke. I was amazed at her writing itself. I was both impressed not only by the content, what she was talking about, but her brilliance of writing. She was a spectacular writer who belongs in the canon of literature, surely American literature, because she wielded words as any sharp swords person does. I mean, it's just brilliance on paper, and reading her, I mean, my hair just blew back. And you know, the listeners today are going to get the opportunity to listen to her, because her writing is translated very quickly and easily in her speeches. I mean, she's just as fiery, just as volcanic, and just astounding in her energy and her scope of putting together different ideas. And she had inspired people several times spontaneously to demonstrate and to organize and to create groups out of her speeches. So for me, it was she spoke to me as a woman, my experiences sexually, my experiences politically, and I really did feel connected to her work.
And Lila, how about for you?
I was first introduced to Andrea's work back in the early 90s when I was working with the Portland Women's Crisis Line and Tess Weishart. And then back in 97, when I was at University of Michigan and worked with Catherine McKinnon, that was, you know, a further introduction to how important Andrea's work is. And I like to say that I have a daughter in her 20s. I felt that Andrea's work was so major that I didn't want to tell my daughter about it. I wanted her to come across it on her own, and I knew she would. And one day my daughter called me. She was attending Harvard Divinity School and was working in the Radcliffe Library. She says, Mom, I found a new writer. I found a new writer, and it's a whole new voice, and it's like McKinnon, but it's not, it's different. Mom, have you heard of Andrea Dworkin? So I said, yeah, honey, I have.
So the generations are aware of Andrea Dworkin, the different generations are becoming aware of her work. We're going to hear an excerpt now from the KABU Archives speech that Andrea Dworkin gave in 1985 here in Portland at Reed College. In excerpting Andrea Dworkin, I had to be somewhat careful because what's allowable on the radio, because of regulations from the FCC, is different today than it was in 1985, I think, when this was first played. So in the first part of this talk, she does describe the kind of pornographic work that she is protesting against, and she describes it somewhat graphically, and it's I just couldn't use that part today. It's quite powerful, and her descriptions are quite powerful, but we couldn't play that for you now.
Well, I want to definitely let the listeners know that in honor of Andrea, another amazing feminist activist, Nikki Kraft, has developed a website where people can go and listen to all of this unabridged. And I want to give thanks to KABU for KABU's generosity in contributing to the Andrea Dworkin Library. This interview will be on AndreaDworkin.net, so people can go and hear it completely unedited.
Okay. This particular excerpt, though, that I did pull out for this program is from that speech, and it follows Andrea's descriptions of pornography, and she's basically in this excerpt talking about the idea that she must prove to others that pornography hurts someone, and so that's what we're going to hear now.
We don't believe that freedom is defined by how badly we can hurt other people, even using words. So the society says, well, that's very interesting, and of course you live in a country where you can think anything you want. But then when you don't go away, what they say is, prove to us that it does any harm. All right? So everybody's still acting as if, listen, you women, you're not all that rational. I mean, you have a long history of not being all that rational, right? I mean, your hormones are, you know, well-known. You have well-known hormones. You have a history of repeatedly misunderstanding your own situation. I mean, you keep telling us rape is important. We keep explaining to you that it isn't. All right? You keep telling us you don't have freedom of speech. We explain to you that you do. All right? So let's be civil with each other. And, you know, if you girls can find the time, you know, come back and you prove to us that this hurts anyone. And we say, look at the photograph. That is of someone, not something. Someone. And they say, there you go again. Right? So we say, okay, we care enough. And we for ourselves have defined one of the political goals of feminism. And that is how to turn that woman in the photograph from something into someone. Many of us, being radical, go a step further and we say, actually, our secret agenda is that we want to cut her down from the meat hook. Don't tell anyone, because they'll say it's the inevitable evolving of fascism in America. We actually want to take her down. The secret is out. We don't think she belongs there. So they say, okay, look, just show us something that we can use, girls. And we say, okay, fine. Look at all the women who are being hurt in these photographs. They're the first women who are hurt by pornography. They're being hurt. Here is the photograph. Here is the proof. They say, well, but women like that, don't they? Women want that. Not all women, just those women, just the ones who happen to be there. Right? Who were born on a certain day, or something genetic happened to them, or something, and they came out of the womb saying, I don't want to be a neurosurgeon, I don't want to be a lawyer, and I don't want to be president of the United States. It stinks. What I want is to go and find me a man with a camera and ask him to hurt me. That's what I want. And you better believe that that's how all those women got in all those photographs, if you accept the premise that women want to be in them. So whatever happens to the women in the photograph doesn't matter, but we still found out a lot about what happens to the women in the photographs, and 65% to 70% of them have been victims of incest or child sexual abuse. They're poor. They're not rich. Most of the time, poverty is a political issue for people. If you see people being hurt, and you know that they come from a very vulnerable class of people, you might think something's up with that. You might want to scrutinize it. You might want to pay some attention to it in your political lives. We know that pornography is used in rape. We know that it's used in forcing prostitutes to do things that they want to do, don't want to do, that they are forced to do the things that are in the pornography. And we know that women in marriages are forced to do the things that are in the pornography. And we know that women who go to college are forced to do the things in the pornography. We've seen the actual existence in emergency rooms throughout the country of throat rape after the release of a film called Deep Throat. And a whole lot of men thought that was really plausible, and so they did it to someone. And she died or she got badly hurt. The woman in the film to whom it happened was held captive, terrorized, beaten, raped, and also had to be hypnotized before it could be done to her. Rape crisis centers in the last 8 years have reported an increasing use of cameras in rapes. The rapes are filmed. The films aren't used as evidence that a rape has taken place. They're used as evidence of consent to a sex act. In other words, the woman wanted it, and the films are on the commercial pornography market, and they are, under current law, protected speech. Now imagine it was you. And we're told, sometimes very self-righteously, sometimes very sincerely, by people, well, you can prosecute the rapist, but the expression is separate. The expression. And we say the film is part of the rape. And as long as the film is on the market, the rape is going on. There were many gang rapes modeled on Custer's Revenge, which was a pornographic video game. And we find pornography at the center of gang rape. It's used in marital rape and battery. The FBI, always being quick on the uptake, had discovered battery, the good news. It didn't exist, according to them, a while ago. Now they say it's the most commonly committed violent crime in the country. One woman is battered every 18 seconds. Pornography is used in the actual torture of women, as I described torture before. Pornography is used as a form of harassment in education. It's used to create compliance and terror in the home. It's used to create fear and vulnerability for women on the street, especially street harassment in neighborhoods, because in most cities, in most places, the politicians who collude with the pornographers all the time have given them parts of the city. And the parts of the city that they've given them are where poor people live, or working class people live, or people of color live, systematically throughout the country. And those neighborhoods are saturated with pornography. And the women who live there live lives of unmitigated hell. They are treated as if they are the women in the pornography who want to be treated that way.
And you've been listening to an excerpt of a talk given by Andrea Dworkin at Reed College in October of 1985. We're here with two activists on the issue of anti-pornography, anti-prostitution, Patricia Barrera and Lila Lee, and they're going to now give some more information.
Wow, all I can say is she still blows my hair back, what's left of it, and I got to tell you, the other interesting observation is how relevant that information still is, just horribly relevant. My work with prostituted people, it's disturbing to think of what she's describing continues. We haven't made as much of a significant dent, although we have, and I'm very thrilled about it. I'm very impressed by her commitment to feminism and dedication to women's rights and fighting as hard as she did. She's an amazing warrior. And I absolutely do want to make note of her relevancy to torture in her conversations about torture. I think she had much to say about it, relevance to what's going on in the world today in conversations about torture, and recommend people to consider reading her book, Scapegoat,
The Jews, Israel, and Women's Liberation. That book is an amazing book. Scapegoat is was just published recently. So
she spent 9 years writing that book.
Yeah, that was, in fact, a lot of people said that's what contributed to her failing health. It was such a huge, almost a decade in the making, very relevant today.
Horrifying. She had to review all that Holocaust literature.
And so I want to talk about, though, even though it sounds like things have not gotten better for prostituted women in particular, women in general, in terms of pornography being made of us or us being used as whores and defined as whores, I want to talk about what she's done legally and the impact she has made on law, American law, as well as international law, with Sweden and Canada, some other countries taking up some of her ideas and turning them into some amazing law.
Well, having a legal background, it's very interesting to me that although Andrea wasn't a lawyer, she turned out to have an enormous impact on American law. And I want to acknowledge her now as one of the great interdisciplinary theorists and writers of the 20th century. She wove together social science, feminism, law, and literature into some very powerful, groundbreaking theories. And Andrea let a genie out of the bottle, and that genie can't be put back in. We all know the Constitution protects freedom of speech under the First Amendment, and it also protects equality under the Fifth and Fourteenth Amendments. And those are comfortable abstractions, and Andrea sort of pierced the veil of those abstractions and made us look at what happens, at what we have to do when some people's freedom of speech winds up destroying other people's equality. And the sex industry, you know, as we've already talked about today, pornography has been extremely protected under the First Amendment. And Andrea, together with Catherine McKinnon, was the first person to ever create any sort of a legal remedy that actually addressed that. And that was with the anti-pornography ordinance that she and Catherine developed in the 1980s that gave women a right to a civil action to sue for money damages when they had been hurt in the making of pornography, as a result of pornography, or having pornography forced upon them. And I want to read something from the book In Harm's Way, The Pornography Civil Rights Hearings, which is the permanent public record of the testimony of men and women. Women cannot function as citizens in this world of social and sexual predation. The woman is excluded from recognizably human dialogue by the pornographic uses to which she is put. Sex discrimination keeps more than half the population of this country from being able to enjoy the benefits, the full benefits of free speech, because they are too poor to buy speech, too silenced through sexual abuse to articulate in a credible way their experience, too despised because of their sex to be able to achieve the public significance required to exercise speech in a technologically advanced society.
Great. Thank you, Lila Lee. So let's go now to the second segment we have from Andrea Dworkin, a speech from 1985. This is the conclusion of her talk, and it does relate to the ordinance that you talked about as she begins by referring back to that ordinance.
Our law was struck down in federal district court by a judge who many of you may have read was a woman. What you didn't read is that she is a Reagan appointee. She said that sex discrimination never has any weight against any First Amendment claim, ever. It was then found unconstitutional in an appeals court by another Reagan appointee. And what he said was even more remarkable. He said that pornography does exactly what we say it does. He said, and I'm just barely paraphrasing him, this is almost a direct quote, that it causes women to get lower pay, that it causes insult and injury in the home, and rape and battery on the street. He said that what that proves is its power as speech, and that therefore it is protected. He gave as examples that were analogous to what pornography does, actual genocides that had occurred as a result of what he considered to be freedom of speech. He specifically mentioned the Nazis, the German ones, not the American ones, and the Ku Klux Klan. In other words, he said, yes, sometimes people die, but it doesn't matter. His finding means that women's bodies really are men's speech, and that this government doesn't care what happens to us, what anybody does for us. And you may have heard people say to you, or you may have said it to somebody else at some point. It's a wonderful sentence. We have to pay a price for freedom. Well, the deal is that women pay the price and men have the freedom. And I want you to note, as a matter of fact, not as a matter of interpretation, but as a matter of fact, that conservative judges protect pornography when it is attacked as male dominance over women. I'm going to ask you to think about some things. The first thing is that if you have ever in your life cared about the fact that somebody, probably a man, but you probably didn't notice it, was being tortured somewhere, anywhere in the world, at any time, probably in a prison, but maybe not, then you have got to care about the fact that women are being tortured for entertainment. You have to. We women often pretend that we really live in a world of equality and recognition of our worth as human beings, because we can't bear the reality that anybody would find rape to be a form of entertainment, or that our lives could ever be so worthless as the pornography industry makes very clear. Our lives are worthless. I'm telling you, we can't do it anymore. That we have to face this. All of our efforts for economic reform depend on understanding what the pornography industry is doing to us and the consequences that it is having for us. Do you know what it means that we conducted a reform campaign for the Equal Rights Amendment while the pornography industry doubled from $4 billion a year to $8 billion a year, and men were coming to us being pissed on? Do you know how ludicrous it is that we were running around the country saying, listen, we're all in this together, please just write it down in the Constitution somewhere that we're all equal, that's all we want? The same thing is now happening with comparable worth. Women are not accidentally paid less in the labor market. There are reasons for it. And what we want to believe is, we have such a deep belief in the humanity of men. And what we say is, we think that if we just point it out to them, we say, look, you know, listen, excuse me, up there, excuse me, you've got your foot on my neck. And I'm really having a lot of trouble breathing. Now, this is the deal. If you would just move your foot so you could put it over there, and you'd be fine. I mean, really, you'd be okay. You'd have 2 feet on the ground. See, I'm not the ground. I mean, that's the news in this. Don't get upset. Don't get angry. I meant nothing by it. I'm just pointing out to you, I'm not the ground. See, the ground's over there. Please. And what happens is that the heel grinds in deeper. And if we don't face that, we're not going to get anywhere. The commitment to inequality in this country is real. It's not a mistake. And people are getting sexual pleasure from it. Now, the pornographers manufacture the exploitation and abuse of women. First they make it and then they sell it. And no bill of rights worth the name can sanction such injury and such harm to a class of people because of a condition of birth and still have any integrity as a bill of rights. It becomes a bill of wrongs. It has become a shield for parasites and for pimps. And it has become a weapon against the powerless. No country can protect torture as speech and flock to see it as entertainment and talk civil liberties. I do not agree to find the definition of my rights and my freedoms in any such arrangement of power. It is power we are talking about, not freedom. Power. Nor do vast numbers of women who refuse to be used anymore. This movement against pornography by women is a movement of the most powerless of women. It's a movement of women against pimps, against rapists, against organized crime, It's a movement of incest victims, of poor women, of illiterate women, of married women who have had no voice, of women who have been forced into prostitution. And defense of pornography, understand, defense of pornography is war against the most powerless on behalf of those who use them. And the profit in pornography is both money and pleasure, not just one and not just the other. Now, we are going to make social policy that repudiates calculating the worth of women in what we can be sold for. We are going to force social policy and the legal system to recognize the worth of women as human beings with human rights. What we're doing is really that simple. And I am here promising you that we are going to accomplish something so simple and yet something that has been resisted throughout history. It is a miracle. It is a miracle that there are women who are alive enough inside to want to do it. They are organizing. They're not going to be shut up again. You can't put them down. You can't shut them up. This society is going to honor our worth as human beings. I promise you. Thank you very much for listening to me.
And you've been listening to the late Andrea Dworkin, 1985, speaking at Reed College. Patricia Barrera and Lila Lee, your last words.
Happy birthday, Andrea. For those who want to hear the full speech and other speeches that she's given, please check out AndreaDworkin.net.
The World Wide Web. Andrea lives. Thanks a lot.
Imagine there's no heaven.
Good.
It's easy if you try. No hell below. Above us only sky. Imagine all the people living. Imagine there's no country.
This is KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from St. John's Books, North Portland's full-service independent bookstore offering new and used books on progressive politics, literature, poetry, titles for kids, and more. St. John's Books is located at 8622 North Lombard in St. John's. Information at 503-283-0032 or via email at info@stjohnsbooks.com. Stay tuned for Stage and Studio.
Welcome to Stage and Studio. This is Emily Young filling in for Dina Roberts. My guests today are Olga Sanchez with Miracle Theater and playwright Joanne Farias, who has written The Road to Xibalba. And this is the world premiere. It was written as part of a NEA grant, I believe, for a playwright residency. Is that right, Olga?
NEA-TCG, National Endowment for the Arts, and TCG is Theater Communications Group. It is the national advocacy group for theater.
Okay, I was curious what TCG meant.
Yeah.
Okay. And so you did a residency here, and now you've moved down from Seattle.
That's right.
And for those of you who aren't familiar with Joanne Farias, she is a playwright who did Tino Does Time and also
Claudia Meets Fulano Colorado.
That's right. And the Tino Does Time won the Richard Hugo Award, and also you have had literary works published in the likes of Amherst Review and Dialogue, so not a newcomer, anyway,
not
to
so
playwriting. Not so shabby. Studied under Edward Albee, and we're honored, I think, to have you in Portland now a resident.
which is a great and beautiful thing. Hopefully we can keep you here. So
well,
you opened your world premiere last Friday, and you run through the 14th at Milagro.
Correct. We perform on Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturday nights and Sunday matinees. And we're really delighted that on Thursday evenings and Sundays after the shows, thanks to support from the Oregon Council for the Humanities, we have post-play discussions with the playwright, Joanne, also with local anthropologist, Dr. William Weir, and our sound designer and musician, Gerardo Calderon. So
tell me why, Joanne, would there be an anthropologist there? Let's just do a brief summary of The Road to Xibalbá.
Well, The Road to Xibalbá, the first act starts with an anthropologist going down to Guatemala to study Mayan shamanism. Unfortunately, he goes down during the height or the towards the beginning of the Civil War and gets caught up in the explosion that's taking place in that country and has to leave before he's really finished with his field work. The second act takes place in Chichen Itza, Mexico, where his son, who is a psychologist, high school teacher, has brought a group of Latino high school students down to see the ruins sort of as a cultural experience.
So the work with our local anthropologist and anthropology in general is not only to support, he's been part of the process, in other words, coming to the readings and listening to the plays. It's developed over the past year and just sort of going, yeah, actually, Joanne, you've got it right, or saying, well, you know, an anthropologist might this, might that, or we would call that this or call that that. So not only for professional expertise, but also because the whole field of anthropology, one, is relatively new. It's only a bit over 100, maybe 150 years old. And the study of Mayan civilization, or what we call classical Mayan civilization, is also only a bit over 100 years old as well. The code, the Mayan language, was only cracked about 15 years ago. So it's really every year there's a new discovery that's happening around Mayan civilization. And so he was really up to date on all that. As is Joanne, who spent the last year studying intensively and the last few years studying intensively Mayan civilization, Mayan culture.
And Joanne, you spent some time in Guatemala. You were there.
I did. I went down to Guatemala to study the Mayan language, Che. And spent a couple of months doing that. I can proudly say that at one time I was able to read first grade reading materials in the Quiche language.
That's fascinating. And also the part of the play here that really fascinates me is its spiritual aspect and how you bring in not only the troubles, the actual troubles that people are going through with, I believe, in the initial write-up on your website, which I want to give out so people can go and look at the history and all the writings you have there, because it's just fascinating to me, is about how the land and resources are wanted by Western Europeans, how their souls are wanted by the missionaries and the Protestants, and their muscle is wanted by the communists, and their stories are wanted by the anthropologists. I thought that was a very, very true.
There's a lot of resource, and I mean it's in a nutshell the history of Latin America. There's an immense amount of resource that people have identified and gone after, and part of it now is the souls, which is infringing upon the traditional indigenous spiritual practice. And people are finding it very hard to maintain that tradition because it's so alluring, because the call of, in this case, Protestantism, or the call of, again, in this story, liberation theology, Catholicism, linked with Catholicism, to practice other traditions because they're going to benefit you in different ways, in more modern ways, or seemingly more productive ways. And the truth is, or what we try to get at, or what Joanna's tried to get at with the play, is that you really do lose out when you give up these traditions. And the notion that true spirituality is, it's good for us.
You must have researched, because you mentioned it on the site, neurotheology, and in your writings, Joanne, and again, I am speaking with Joanne Farias and Olga Sanchez with Miracle Theater about The Road to Xibalbá, which had its world premiere last Friday and again runs through October 14th. And the number to call for information or tickets is 503 236
7253, and the website to go to is milagrotheater.org.
Milagro.org.
Is that it, just milagro.org?
Yeah.
Okay. But if you put in Milagro Theater on any search engine, you're going to find it. And go
even
there
Wikipedia.
And just glean over it. It's fascinating. And I also like that you have the Chiche words and the definitions along the side in the sidebar. That was brilliant. But you must have researched neurotheology and the gene that has been discovered that some of us have, I guess maybe some of us don't, that where we have a tendency towards spirituality and religion, and also for how it can work to heal ourselves, and how that's important to Mayan beliefs. So what was your impetus there? Where did you get that? Where, did it just come naturally, or did you have an idea that that's where it was going to go initially?
I was trying to determine why people have different experiences in consciousness when they practice different religious practices. I think it's safe to say that when people meditate and they say they experience a feeling of bliss, or when they perform shamanic practices and say that they hear the voices of the gods, that we ought to pay attention. Enough people have reported hearing the voices of the gods and feeling a number of sensations that I think it's important to look at what is really going on and not just dismiss it outright. The field of neurotheology attempts to isolate and identify the brain processes that take place while people are engaged in various spiritual practices. And they have identified why all religions seem to have certain structural similarities and have tracked them down to the brain processes, and found that contrary to simply being silly superstition, shamanic practices are very natural and ordinary ways of looking at the world. And we have in the Western world, in a way, trained ourselves not to have these experiences. We have shied away from the type of spiritual practice and ritual that would cause them to happen. We have inculcated ourselves with the beliefs that if they happen, we are insane. And so we're missing out on an entire aspect of communication with our own unconscious that indigenous people have, that that might actually be very beneficial for us to experience.
And this is where a shaman comes in?
Well,
to help people who...
It's a fascinating thing, actually. It works on so many different levels, as I understand it, and I'm no scholar in this at all. But the shaman is, in essence, someone who permits you to have these experiences and guides you through these experiences, who will show you how to have those experiences or will train you in those experiences. And it's basically about finding those experiences that will heal you specifically. And one of the things about shamanic tradition is that there isn't a cure-all. The shaman will deal with you on a very individual level and look for the thing or look for the way that is going to best serve you in order for you really to to heal yourself. That's
came to were killed and buried and obliterated, except the head of one was placed in a squash tree. A woman, a maiden of the underworld, went up to the head and began talking to it, and it spat in her hand, and she became pregnant with the second set of the Hero Twins. And she came up to the above ground, gave birth to this second set of Hero Twins, and they were genetically half sky power and half underworld. So they had both the goodness and the righteousness and the rationality of the sky powers, as well as the instinctual passion and cunning of the underworld powers. So this second set of hero twins were summoned and descended into the underworld and actually beat the lords of the underworld, resurrected their father, the corn god, and became the sun and the moon. So it was through their instrumentality that the sun rose the first day, and we began to have life on Earth as we know it. So I structured the play. I determined that this myth was just too difficult for people to hear intellectually and comprehend. They weren't getting it in the early readings. So I decided to simply, instead of tell the story of the Popol Vuh, the play should be the Popol Vuh. So the first act of the play is the sky powers, the father who is all intellect, experiencing this underworld journey and failing. And he marries this woman, and they have a child who is half sky power, half blood. And the second set of hero twins, represented by the sun, then takes the underworld journey, and he succeeds. So that the structure of the play, in a way, mirrors the myth.
And yet, when you go to see the play, it probably won't hit you right in the head that that's what's happening to you, because you're dealing with modern-day problems with a group of kids that he's taken along with him. And this is Joe, the son.
Mm-hmm.
And I here I am telling you your own story. But I'm telling the folks listening, of course, that and I wanted to talk about the children that you have, not children, but the teens that you have, which are part of your Pluma Nueva. And we don't have a whole lot of time, but you had a writing group, a bilingual writing group, and you have, I think, Albert Alcazar.
Alcazar,
David Galindo, and Anna Garcia.
Yeah, we're so delighted. Pluma Nueva is a program that we began 3 years ago, and it's a bilingual writing and performance program, and high school students are invited from all over town to come as an after-school program, develop writing skills, develop their original pieces, and then they go through a series of training programs, this training program, and then they perform their original works. So David Galindo and Ana Garcia have been in the project since the beginning, and they keep coming back. And Albert joined us last year. And Joanne was actually our writing instructor last year.
Oh, really? So you worked with these kids, and they were, and so you've been able to see them grow up, probably.
It's been phenomenal. Roles. And so when we were doing the play, I just thought this is a great opportunity to take some of these youth and graduate them, if you will, into a main stage production. And it is their stage debut. It has been just exciting to watch them integrate with the professional actors, become professionals, understand what the requirements are for professionalism, learn their lines, develop characters, understand what developing characters means, develop their stage presence, perform as deities, perform as dancers, percussionists.
Is this still available through Milagro?
Pluma Nueva?
Yeah.
Oh, absolutely.
Are you still doing that? Everywhere. So is
that
the same number to call for information on that?
503-236-7253
is the number to call for information about Pluma Nueva, or The Road to Xibalba, which is apparently the road to the underworld and the place of phantoms, and also to have an entertaining evening. This is a world premiere, so it hasn't been seen by anybody else before. I'm Joanne Farias. I want to thank you, the playwright, for coming to Cabo. The time went so quickly, I can't even believe it, to come to Cabo to speak with us about The Road to Xibalba, and also to, and you too, Olga Sanchez, who's been the artistic director at Milagro for 4 years. Now this is going on your fourth year.
Yeah.
And just to remind people again, it is 503-236-7253 or at milagro.org. That's M-I-L-A-G-R-O, milagro.org. The theater is located at 525 Southeast Stark. They're running through the October 14th, and you said Thursday through Sunday?
Yeah.
So is there a matinee on Sunday?
It is
well?
2 o'clock on Sunday.
And it just sounds absolutely fascinating, every single bit of it. And
thank you.
And again, go to the website, please, everyone. And you say there is discussions?
Thursdays and Sundays.
Okay, well, that just sounds like a lot of fun. And again, I want to remind people that I have been speaking with Joanne Farias, who is the playwright of The Road to Xibalba, and the director of The Road to Xibalba, Olga Sanchez, which stars Stephen Lisk, as well as Edward Lyons, David Loftus, and Stephanie Dana, as well as Albert Alcazar, David Galindo, and Anna Garcia.
So please, folks, it sounds like if you're interested, please check that out and do so before the 14th.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Yeah. And now we turn to I'm going to go ahead and let yourselves out. You can sit here if you like, but you probably want to go. Mm-hmm. I'm going to be speaking on the phone with Stan Foote from the Oregon Children's Theater about if you give a mouse a cookie. Stan, are you there?
I'm here. Hi, Olga.
He says, hi, Olga.
Hi, Stan.
There you go.
How'd it go? How is Loden?
Loden's good.
Yay.
Yeah, for those of you who don't know what Loden is, it's not a coat. Although it can be a coat, Loden is they're going into the Newmark Theater with If You Give the Mouse a Cookie, which is opens the 30th and runs through the 15th at Newmark Theater at the Portland, what's that called?
Center for the Performing Arts.
Portland Center for the Performing Arts. And I'm just curious, you say it's a children's book. Did you adapt that or had it already been adapted?
It had already been adapted. If You Give a Mouse a Cookie is one of the first reads that children have. It's one of those books that kids memorize and pretend like they're reading, and all of a sudden they are reading it. So it's a pretty fun story for a small child, but it's going to be a very fun story for everybody in the audience. This is hilarious. It's great physical comedy.
Now you have a very, very tall young man playing a teenage boy.
I have not teenage, a 10-year-old boy.
A
10-year-old
boy.
I have Matt Haynes, who is 6'9", playing a 10-year-old boy, and I have a kitchen scaled up to his size. So think of a kitchen with counters that are 5'9" tall, a refrigerator that's 11 feet tall, a mop that's 10 feet tall, a broom that's 11 feet tall. So the whole series of things are scaled up to Matt's size.
Whoa! Well,
it's very fun. It's very exciting.
And the mouse that is played by Carrie Silva, Matt Haynes, of course, is the 10-year-old boy. Carrie Silva, for tickets to Oregon Children's Theater's production of If You Give a Mouse a Cookie, which sounds like If You Give a Mouse a Cookie, watch out.
Yeah, this will happen.
Yeah, right. It's 503-228-9571. Do you have a website that people can go to?
We do, www.octc.org.
All right, then. Now, if I was going to bring, I could bring any age child, or is there like a cutoff point?
Well, you know, we recommend our shows for 4 and above, and only because that's an age where we know for sure a child can sit through one of our shows. A lot of parents bring younger children to our shows, and they do very well, but our recommendation is 4 and above.
How about an old age cutoff? I mean,
there is no old age cutoff. This will tickle you silly. If grandparents don't have seniors don't have grandchildren, I'd go out and adopt a couple of grandchildren to bring them to this show, or just sit my children and pretend you came with them. This is a very funny show.
So my children are 23 and 24.
They're going to have fun.
Will they enjoy the show?
They'll have
bring
fun.
Them?
Yes.
Okay. Well, we might just do that. We might just have to make a day of it. You know, since I still have Olga and Joanne Farias here, the playwright from Road to Xibalba,
uh-huh.
I don't know if you're familiar with that, or with the myth cycle of the Popol Vuh. Is that how you say it?
Popol Vuh.
Popol Vuh. The Popol Vuh, but they're doing a show there we've just been speaking about. I don't know if you were able to hear any of the interview.
I was hearing that. Olga Sanchez is one of my favorite people, and that she's working with young people right now and bringing them into the theater, that is, our missions are definitely in line. I love that she's doing that, and I know that she's committed to it. We're buddies.
So you guys both do children's classes, too, don't you? And I know that you do older children mostly, right?
Well, Plumanueva is for High school kids. Through the Teatro Milagro program, which is the touring component of the Miracle Theater Group, there's a lot of residency that focuses on not only theater skills, but also literacy.
So you could have Milagro come to your schools. And how about Oregon Children's Theater? Do you have classes for children as well?
Well, fortunately, we've been able to partner with Olga Sanchez and Teatro Milagro, Miracle Theater, every summer for the last 4 or 5 summers, presenting classes in their space. And they give us a great deal because our missions, again, align,
mm-hmm.
and they help us and advise us. And we actually last year did a show in partnership with Teatro Milagro Miracle Theater. So we're big fans of each other.
Absolutely. So are you going to any plans to do that again in the future?
We keep talking. We're trying.
We'd love
to find the right script. We talked this morning about one.
Yeah. Oh, we have a playwright in the room right now.
There you go.
Here I am. Maybe she could come up with something. If you could combine The Road to Xibalba, which is basically the place of phantoms, so we might think of H.E. Double Toothpicks, or is this a different type of dark place?
You know, The Road to Xibalba could be done for children. I mean, there are bats and jaguars and macaws. Oh, it's a great thing for kids.
And do you have sets? You have the ruins of Chichen Itza, so we're there. But the sacred ball game, maybe clean that up a little bit for the kids.
Oh, why the heck not?
Well, Stan, I want to thank you for joining us by phone and taking time out of rehearsal and load in, which I know is a hectic time. And I'm sorry about the confusion about what time you're going to be on today and everything. So
thank you for having me on.
And again, Olga and Joanne from Milagro, thank you for coming. I'll give the numbers out again for the Milagro show, which is The Road to Xibalba, written by Joanne Farias and directed by Olga Sanchez. The number for tickets is 503-236-7253. And for tickets to Give a Mouse a Cookie, or If You Give a Mouse a Cookie, which is at the Newmark Theater running through October 15th, is 278-9571. That's 503-278-9571. Anything else anybody would like to add in the next 30 seconds?
Break a leg, Stan. I know it's going to be great.
I think he's gone.
Okay.
So he's gone, and, well, you two break a leg as well, or you break a pin nib, or whatever writers break. And, again, thank you for joining us here on Stage and Studio. This is Emily Young, and I'm filling in for D-May, and I'll be filling in next week with Imago Theater's new play that they've got coming out. I think it's Betrayal, Harold Pinter's Betrayal. So we'll be talking about that next week, and we'll talk to you then.
You're tuned to KBOO Portland 90.7 FM. Stay tuned for Democracy Now!
From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now! Broadcasting from Salt Lake City, Utah.
It's not my job to decide who's going to live or who's going to die. That's something that I've had to deal with morally, and that I'm convinced of. Nothing is more clear in my mind that war is wrong.
Army medic Agustin Aguayo, denied conscientious objector status. He was deployed to Iraq after the military ordered him to return for a second tour of duty. He went AWOL at his base in Germany. Today, he turns himself in. We bring you a Democracy Now! Exclusive and extended conversation with Agustin Aguayo and his wife Helga. Then, Rocky Anderson, the mayor of Salt Lake City, will talk about war, protests, and the Bush administration. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Salt Lake City. Bush administration has slipped in a major change to the Senate bill on interrogations that would allow U.S. citizens to be detained as enemy combatants. Initially, the bill defined an enemy combatant as anyone who engaged in hostilities against the United States or its allies, but the definition has been expanded to include anyone who has materially supported hostilities against the United States or its allies. The Washington Post reports human rights experts expressed concern the language in the new provision would be a precedent-setting congressional endorsement for indefinite detention of U.S. citizens. Meanwhile, on Monday, a group of activists from Code Pink stood up in protest over the bill during a Senate Judiciary Committee hearing. The activists stood with their backs toward the senators while wearing T-shirts that spelled out the phrase, "No torture." The activists called on the senators to remove a section of the bill that strips detainees of the right to habeas corpus. Three retired military officers who served in Iraq called on Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld to resign during a hearing on Capitol Hill Monday. This is retired Major General John Batiste, who commanded the 1st Infantry Division in Iraq.
Donald Rumsfeld is not a competent wartime leader. He knows everything except how to win. Minded and compliant subordinates who do not grasp the importance of the principles of war, the complexities of Iraq, or the human dimension. Bottom line, his plan allowed the insurgency to take root and metastasize to where it is today.
General Batiste went on to say the Iraq war has fueled Islamic fundamentalism across the globe and created more enemies for the United States. Retired Major General Paul Eaton also testified Monday and called for Rumsfeld's resignation.
The president is not well served by the Secretary of Defense, a man history will not treat kindly. So what to do? Replace the Secretary of Defense with a proven leader who has a vision to get the country's defense establishment back on track. The Army is in terrible shape. The Marines are not much better. A secretary who understands how to build alliances at home and abroad, who understands the operational art and understands the contemporary operating environment we live in.
Meanwhile, the Los Angeles Times reports the Army's top officer withheld his required 2008 budget plan from Pentagon leaders last month in protest. General Peter Schoomaker did this to signal to Rumsfeld that the service could not maintain its current level of activity without billions in additional funding. Schoomaker is seeking a 41% budget increase for the Army. Meanwhile, the Pentagon announced Monday soldiers of the 1st Brigade, 1st Armored Division, will be extending staying in Iraq, and the 4th Brigade, 1st Cavalry Division, will deploy to Iraq next month, 30 days earlier than scheduled. The U.S. has 142,000 troops in Iraq. In other military news, the Pentagon announced Monday three U.S. Marines will go on trial for murdering an unarmed Iraqi civilian in Hamdaniya in April. In political news, a former college football teammate of Virginia Senator George Allen has publicly accused him of frequently referring to African Americans by using the N-word. The accusation came from a radiologist in North Carolina named Kendall Shelton. Shelton said Allen had nicknamed him Wizard because his name was similar to a former imperial wizard of the Ku Klux Klan. Shelton also recounted an episode 30 years ago in which he and Allen and a third friend shot a deer while hunting. Shelton said Allen cut the deer's head off, asked directions to the home of the nearest black person, and shoved the head into that person's oversized mailbox. On Monday, Senator Allen called Shelton's recollections absolutely false, pure fabrication, and nonsense. But later that day, a professor at Alabama University came forward to say he, too, heard Allen use an inflammatory epithet for African Americans. The New Republic reported in April Allen had worn a Confederate flag pin in his high school yearbook picture. Allen's campaign against Democratic contender James Webb has suffered great lengths since he was caught on tape referring to a man of Indian descent as a macaca. In other political news, a group calling itself the National Black Republican Association has begun taking out radio ads in Maryland and Ohio, urging African Americans to vote Republican. The ads have been widely criticized for distorting the historical record of Martin Luther King and the Ku Klux Klan.
Dr. King was a real man.
You know he was a Republican.
Dr. King, a Republican?
Democrats passed those black codes and Jim Crow laws. Democrats started the Ku Klux Klan.
White hoods and sheets?
Democrats fought all civil rights legislation from the 1860s to the 1960s. Democrats released those vicious dogs and fire hoses on blacks.
Seriously?
And the Dixiecrats? We named Democrats and vowed to vote for a yellow dog before a Republican. Republicans freed us from slavery and put our right to vote in the Constitution.
In international news, the Israeli military is continuing to hold 18 Palestinian lawmakers after an Israeli court denied them bail Monday. The politicians also face possible trials for their membership in Hamas. They were seized in a series of raids in Gaza and the West Bank. The lawmakers include Palestinian Parliament Speaker Aziz Dweik and several Palestinian cabinet members. Talib Asana, a Palestinian member of the Israeli Knesset, criticized Israel's move.
Decision of the court to continue of the arrest of the Palestinian parliament and ministers, and I think that's a political decision.
In Nepal, 24 people have died after a helicopter chartered by the conservation group World Wildlife Fund crashed. There were no survivors. On board were 17 Nepalis, a Finnish diplomat, two Americans, a Canadian, an Australian, and two Russians. This is WWF Director James Lee.
There were 24 people on this helicopter, including seven staff of WWF. Altogether, it represented some of the most important leadership of the conservation movement in Nepal, and certainly many of the leaders of WWF's efforts in Nepal and elsewhere. It is a huge loss for this organization, but also for conservation in Nepal, and of course for the families of these 24 people.
There's a development in the case of Tariq Ramadan, the prominent Swiss Muslim intellectual who was blocked from entering the United States to accept a teaching position at the University of Notre Dame. After a two-year wait, the United States has officially rejected his visa on the grounds that he once gave money to a French-based Palestinian charity. The United States claims the organization has ties to Hamas, even though it's a legal charity in France. Ramadan criticized the government's rejection of his visa, saying it was done for ideological reasons. Ramadan is now teaching at Oxford. In Charlotte, North Carolina, six people were arrested Saturday at the city's Human Rights Fest. Police shot one protester with a taser stun gun. Another protester, David Crane, was hospitalized with broken ribs and a punctured lung. Protest organizers said four or five police officers held Crane down and beat him. The police attempted to shut down the gathering, even though organizers had a permit. 700 people have already signed an online petition calling on the police to drop the charges filed against the arrested protesters. Organizers in Charlotte are planning to hold another rally Saturday calling for the impeachment of President Bush. Attorneys in Michigan are preparing to file a wrongful death lawsuit against the state's Department of Corrections over the death of a prisoner who suffered from a bipolar disorder. According to the Detroit Free Press, Timothy Joe Saunders died after spending most of his last 4 days with his arms and legs strapped to a steel bed in four-point restraints in a hot isolation cell. He was naked and soaked in his urine. He was 21 years old. Authorities haven't released an autopsy yet, but one expert witness called it death by torture. The Michigan Department of Corrections initially told his family he died in his sleep. Saunders is at least the third mentally ill prisoner to die under similar circumstances in Michigan in recent years. Also expected to be sued in the case is Correctional Medical Services, the private company that handles health services in Michigan's prisons. And in California, Governor Arnold Schwarzenegger has signed a new law requiring the state's massive pension system divest from investing in some companies in Sudan. The bill is narrowly tailored to force divestment of only those companies that provide revenue or weapons to the Sudanese government and refuse to change their practices. Those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report, as we continue our Breaking the Sound Barrier tour through 80 cities. Today we are in Salt Lake City, Utah.